Hi, wrestling fans. It's Tony Schiavone. You're listening to Solid Monster Sounds Off. And we're desperately out of time.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
I like fighting a woman.
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have 2 more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
That time of year, yes, it is the annual Solid Monster Sounds Off Prediction Show. I've gotten so many messages on Twitter. Hey, you doing a prediction show this year? I told you guys last week. This was the week. And it is finally here, but that's coming up later. We got a lot of other stuff to get into first in a week where Finn Balor against Kyle O'Reilly on the New Year's Evil show that NXT did on Wednesday night was probably only the 6th or 7th best match of the week. Any other week, it would have been number one easily, but not this week. And that means we got a lot of great wrestling this week. And there was Legends Night on Raw Monday night. Well, they can't all be winners. This is episode 686. I am the Solid Monster. Getting close to 700. April is when we should hit number 700, just like Babe Ruth did. Or Barry Bonds. If I had all kinds of banned substances running through my bloodstream, hit up that Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. We're always getting new listeners here. A lot of people may not be aware of the fact that you can get one free audiobook of your choosing if you use our link to sign up for a free trial for 30 days of the Audible service. There's a ton of wrestling books up there. The new Young Bucks book that got great reviews that just came out, that's up there. Daniel Bryan, right, his name has been out there. He could potentially be the winner of the Royal Rumble this year. He's got a book up there, too. So go browse around, figure out which one you want to buy. Hey, maybe it's not a wrestling book. Doesn't have to be a wrestling book, but use our link. It helps the podcast. You get one free book, audibletrial.com/solomonster. And if you want to make a PayPal donation and support the podcast, you can do so at any time on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the show, like these fine folks here, including the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, who has become a huge supporter every week on here and YouTube for the podcast, the Sound Off Group Messiah, Jeff Lippman, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Dream Chaser Chauncey Curry, Raymond the Mountie Medina. We've got Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode Brock Joseph. Why do I sound like a chain smoker when I say that? Fast Blast Tim Banks, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, dancing on into the new year. I forgot to wish him a happy 17th birthday last month. I know he turned 17. I hope he and his brothers, Luke and Hunter, and the rest of the family are doing well. Also want to give a shout out to Nenrid, fan of the show since 2012, dropping 5 stars and some love on iTunes. Thank you for the nice review. And a special shout out goes out to Jake, anything but fake, Messicomer. Jake is the real deal. He has been a listener since 2011. If you work at a business in Greater Chicagoland that has a copier or a printer that drives you so insane you want to take a steel chair to it, then Jake is the guy you want to be talking to. Also, has your copier vendor hit you with a low blow and turn heel with expensive contracts or high ink costs? If your printing situation needs better creative, brother, put that chair down and call Jake. Jake will save you so much on your copier contract and service. You'll be marking out for the savings. He'll even go where Vince McMahon would not go with the stars of WCW, and he will buy you out of your contract if need be. Give your office printing situation the push we all know it needs and deserves. Call or email Jake now, 847-463-1980, or wrestleprint@gmail.com is the email address. And all Sound Off listeners right now, pay attention, all Sound Off listeners right now get 20% off and a mystery signed 8.5 by 10 on any order placed. 847-463-1980. Jake will put you over clean. We got more shout-outs coming up a little bit later, so don't worry if you didn't hear your name mentioned. Want to mention to everybody right now, in case you missed the announcement last week, that right now in the private group on Facebook, type in Solomonster Sounds Off so you can find it. You have to apply for membership to be approved, but we are hosting, I should say Zach Holker, more specifically, is hosting the 8th annual Solomonster Sounds Off Royal Rumble Pool. So far, we have over 1,200 entries, still with another 3 weeks left to go. Each person, it's totally free to enter, doesn't cost a thing. Each person will receive a random number to be issued by Zach about a week before the pay-per-view. That number is going to be your number for the men's and the women's Rumble matches this year. If you win your pool, and there could be dozens of pools, once a pool hits 30, it spills over into the next one. If you win your pool, you then move on to the ultimate Royal Rumble pool, where we're going to pick three random prize winners. So you don't win a prize for winning your pool other than bragging rights, but if you go on to the ultimate Rumble, you end up one of the top three winners there, you get a prize. To enter, all you got to do, it's very simple. Go to the Facebook group, apply for membership if you're not already in, find Zach's Rumble Pool post. It's pinned to the top of the page in the announcements section. You may have to go through some of the announcements, but it's in there. Make sure it's the Zach Holker post, and all you got to do is hit the like button. That's it. Hit thumbs up, you're in. You don't even have to leave a comment. Like the post and you're in. The deadline to enter is January 31st, right before the pay-per-view goes on the air that night. So still plenty of time to enter. Prizes to be determined will be awarded to the first, second, and third place winners, as I mentioned, coming out of that final pool. First place winner is going to get a $75 Amazon gift card donated by Julian Cannon. And there is a special bonus courtesy of Julian. I got to give him a shout out on this. In the pinned post, you will find a link to an online form. Whoever correctly guesses the exact time of either the men's or the women's Royal Rumble match will win a free Nintendo Switch. I shit you not. You can win a free Nintendo Switch, but you got to guess it right down to the T. That's a separate thing. You'll find a link. You have to fill out a form and apply. Julian is taking care of all that. And you can thank him for the awesome prize. And again, my thanks to everybody who is helping out with this and contributing prizes. I am not involved in any of that, so if you have questions about that stuff, don't come to me. Go to the group, talk to Zach, talk to Julian. We had an issue a few years ago, and it was too much of a headache for me, so now I am hands-off. I take a hands-off policy with this stuff. But these are some pretty sweet prizes this year, and hopefully we will see you over in the Facebook group. Now, I know some people were wondering when are the top 10 matches of 2020 going to go up. I was hoping to get it up a few days ago. That should be going up on YouTube in the next few days. It is going to come out. It's not out yet. But I have ranked my top 10 matches for 2020, which is not easy. Because there were actually, despite the pandemic and everything, there were a lot of great matches last year. It's always a hard thing to do. You come up with that initial list. You got like 15, 20, 25 matches on there. And then you got to boil it down to the 10 that you think were the best, or the 10 that you enjoyed the most and why. So that's going to be hitting the YouTube channel, maybe the feed. We'll see how long it is, but that'll be hitting the YouTube channel sometime this week. So watch for that. What did hit the feed this week, if you missed it, were two parts of my Wrestle Kingdom 15 review. That did not hit the YouTube channel. That was audio only. So if you missed it, you want to go back and get my thoughts on both nights of Wrestle Kingdom. Both reviews are about half an hour or so. So many great matches, you know, spread out over the course of both nights. Okada and Will Ospreay had an excellent match. Shingo Takagi and Jeff Cobb had just a fantastic war. Unexpectedly great. I expected it to be good, but not that good. Obviously, Kota Ibushi and Tetsuya Naito on night one, with Ibushi becoming the double champion And then Ibushi and Jay White the following night, which I was very happy to see Ibushi make it out with both belts and not have a 24-hour reign. And there was controversy coming out of it in terms of the status of Jay White, who was very downtrodden because of his loss. He lost his mind. And backstage, after the match, he ran the whole gamut of emotions. You watched in the span of about 15 minutes. This guy hit every stage of grief that you could possibly hit, cut one of the best promos of his life, and basically, you know, said that he was going to quit. You know, he would be at the New Year Dash show contractually if New Japan wanted him to be there, but then maybe he was just going to go away, teasing that this was going to be it for him in New Japan. And then we get a tweet from the Super J-Cast podcast, which is a pretty popular New Japan-centric podcast. They've broken some news before. They tweeted that several sources have indicated there is some doubt whether Jay White will extend his New Japan contract, which is rumored to be up at the end of the month. WWE are believed to be making a strong play for him, and it is 50-50 whether or not he stays or goes. And my first thought when I read that was that this makes me very sad. I am sad that I have such little faith in WWE to properly use the talent that they have already, let alone new talent that they bring in. I mean, look, I spend far more time watching WWE programming than I do New Japan. So you would think, well, you know, some big star coming in from another promotion, I should be excited, right? And happy for them because I spend more hours per week watching WWE stuff than anything else. And so therefore, how great would it be to see somebody like Jay White pop up on WWE television? But yet I would much rather he stay right where he is and not go anywhere and stay in New Japan and stay as far away from possible as possible from WWE. And it shouldn't be that way, but that's how it is. Because for every AJ Styles who comes from another company and bypasses NXT for the main roster, I mean, that's rare. What happened with Styles when he came in, that just doesn't happen. Not only did he bypass NXT, had that big Royal Rumble debut, he was mixing it up with Roman Reigns within a month, or not a month, but a few months of making his debut, Chris Jericho, John Cena, all these big names they put him in there with. He beat John Cena multiple matches, became WWE champion before the year was out. I was pleasantly surprised with how they used AJ Styles. They obviously realized what they had in him, despite the fact that he spent the majority of his career in TNA, which for a time WWE supposedly wasn't even considering hiring people from TNA, which is just stupid. It was stupid back then. It's stupid to even think about that now. But they did right by AJ Styles. But for every AJ Styles, you'll find three, four, five other people who they don't do right by, or they drop the ball with, where they don't use to their full potential. Jay White is a great heel. Now, someone emailed me a few months after. This is after Roman Reigns came back. Big heel turn, won the Universal Championship. And he had just started doing the stuff with Jey Uso. He was getting into the feud with Jey Uso. And he asked me who I thought the better heel was. And I think at the time I said Jay White. He's excellent. And I would not have said that a year ago, necessarily. And not that I would have said he sucked or anything, but I had not bought into the hype on Jay White even a year ago. I wasn't sold. In my mind, there was something missing there. But I turned the corner on him pretty quickly. You watch some of his recent work over the past year. If Vince McMahon had his wits about him, Jay White would go straight to the main roster and be a top heel on the brand, similar to, and I make this analogy because this is how I kind of view him. If he had his wits about him, he would sign Jay White, send him right to the main roster, use him as a top heel on either Raw or SmackDown, similar to Triple H in 2000. And I still say 2000 Triple H was the best Triple H. 2000 into the beginning of 2001 was the best version of Triple H before the quad tear. That's who he kind of reminds me of. Not just because of the hair or, you know, anything like that, but No, Triple H was a great heel, and so is Jay White. He just knows that character well. He goes out there, he has great matches. You know, whatever box it is that you want to check off, maybe he's not the biggest guy in the world, but hey, he looks like $1 million. He has come into his own, and he could absolutely be an asset to that company. The question is, would they use him in that way? I hope he stays put. I hope he stays right where he is. If he leaves, here's another question that I pose. If he leaves, if he bails on New Japan, and I'm sure they are hoping to keep him around, they do not want to lose Jay White. They have invested a lot of time and a lot of energy into positioning Jay White as one of the top stars of their company. But how many times will New Japan be burned by a foreign talent before they stop featuring them as high up on the card as they have in recent years? Balor, Styles, Omega. Obviously, there was a lot of kind of bad blood there with the way Omega left. Now, potentially Jay White, if let's say he leaves. They invest a lot of time in these people, grooming them, only for them to just up and leave. I mean, I guess Will Ospreay would take his place as the top gaijin heel in the company, if that happened. But it would be a huge blow to New Japan. Now, they would get over it, and they would slot somebody else in there, and they would move on. But yeah, it would be a big blow to the company. I don't think he's going anywhere. But like I said before, it's sad that my first instinct is the Darth Vader meme where he's just screaming, no, like that's my initial reaction to the news. No, I don't like that. I don't like that. But we'll see what happens. I don't think he's going anywhere though. I think they're playing us like a fiddle. So is he. Yeah, he was liking certain posts on social media and stuff. I see New Japan is still advertising him for some upcoming shows. I don't think he's going anywhere, you ask me. I'll tell you who is going somewhere right out of the company, and that's Marty Scurll. Ring of Honor announced last Monday that it has mutually decided to part ways with Marty Scurll, who only a year ago had signed what was said to be the most lucrative contract ever signed in the history of ROH. He was said to be getting WWE main roster level money for working far fewer dates. And on top of that, not only did they sign him to a big contract as a talent, he was given the book. He replaced Delirious as the head of creative for Ring of Honor, with Delirious working alongside of him and not over him. Marty Scurll basically took over the head creative duties in that company. And he was going to be kind of a player coach type of situation where he was going to be in the ring and he was going to be wrestling and working. And on top of that, he was going to be running the show. It's an unbelievable deal. There was a lot of talk that when his Ring of Honor deal was up, he would almost certainly come. And this is before he signed. But if you remember, you go back over a year, year and a half ago, there was all of this talk that when he was done with ROH, because the only reason he didn't come into AEW with all of his Elite buddies when AEW got started was because contractually he still had a deal that he couldn't get out of with Ring of Honor, and it's almost like they all left him behind. And if you think about it, there was a great story there. If they wanted to go down that road storyline-wise, where when he did come to AEW, he felt betrayed that his friends left him behind. There were so many things you could have done with him. But there was a lot of talk that when his deal was up, he would almost certainly come to AEW and join his friends, but then he re-signed with Ring of Honor. Now, he was also, as part of his deal, allowed to do some work with the NWA. Remember, he was feuding with Nick Aldis over the NWA World's Heavyweight Championship. He had started that. There was hope that he, you know, might even be able to facilitate a working relationship with AEW. Or do, you know, more stuff with New Japan. He could be the conduit to that, which kind of is what Rocky Romero, I think, has become on the New Japan end, where he is sort of the bridge from New Japan to other promotions. And, you know, I said if New Japan and AEW ever do work together, and they will, you can probably credit a lot of that to Rocky Romero. He's got a lot of friends who work in that company. I'm sure the lines of communication are open. You know, and he could have been that person for Ring of Honor. So who knows what kind of doors he could have opened, what kind of relationships he could have helped forge with Ring of Honor and other promotions. This guy was on top of the world. And then not 2 months after re-signing, the pandemic hit and shut everything down. And then a few months after that, his year went from bad to worse with the whole speaking out movement and the allegations that he sexually abused a 16-year-old girl who was intoxicated at the time. This was after a wrestling show, I think an IPW show in the UK, about 5 or 6 years ago. Now, he put statements out, and later on, he didn't deny that, you know, there was something that happened with him and this girl, and he, you know, said that he was consensual, and the age of consent over in the UK is 16, which it is. But Ring of Honor announced that they were investigating, and gave no additional updates for months. It was like the never-ending investigation. Then he was quietly removed from their roster page on the website about a month or two ago. That was the first sign that he probably wasn't coming back, and then this week they made it official. Quite a fall from grace for Marty Scurll. From the biggest deal ever offered, all these options available to him, to out of a job. Persona non grata. All within a 12-month period. How quickly it can all crumble. Now, the Observer says that he owns a home in Florida. And if he's out... And by the way, so does Jay White, I believe. Forgot to mention that. But they say he owns a home in Florida. And if he's out of work for a certain amount of time, and this is what he has to be concerned about, per his work visa, he may have to leave the country. If he doesn't... If he doesn't sign on somewhere else real quick, he may not be able to stay in the U.S. And I saw this rumor that I'm sure a lot of you saw it. I don't know how or where it got started. That WWE is very interested in signing him. That may have been some kind of report that got spawned from old reports from months and months and months ago from The Observer or PW Insider or someplace. I certainly have not seen that anywhere credible. It does not make any sense considering what this person was released for. The reason the Ring of Honor wanted to part ways with him, it's not because they had some kind of personal little petty disagreement. The idea that WWE, of all companies, who they're so conscious about their public image, would swoop in and be waiting with a contract to sign Marty Scurll. I mean, you'd have to be a fool to believe that. I don't believe that for a second. He is not going to WWE. We can put that to bed. He is not on his way. He is not negotiating with WWE. He's not going to AEW either, I don't believe. So, in this country anyway, I don't really see any viable options for him, at least not until some more time has gone by. I mean, you give it 6 months or a year or however long, and all of a sudden Marty Scurll could be this big comeback story in wrestling. But right now, I don't see any paths for him here in this country. His name is too toxic right now. Whether you agree with that or not, that's just the way it is. I'm just telling it to you the way it is. I'm not getting into a whole debate about whether it's right or wrong. I'm just telling you, this guy's name is too toxic right now. Anybody would be a fool to touch him. Ring of Honor could have brought him back. As long as that investigation dragged out for... So much time went by. If they wanted to, they had him under contract. They could have very quietly brought him back without much fanfare. And the fact that they elected not to, no other major promotion is going to want to make a big spectacle out of signing him to a contract. Makes no sense. Maybe New Japan will take him back. In fact, that probably is his likeliest destination if he wanted to go back there. They seem to be more lenient with things like this, so I could see him back in New Japan, sure. But the WWE rumors that were floating around this week, don't buy into them. Got some more shouts here. Tears for Fears, right? Made me think of that for some reason. Russell the Muscle, thank you for the support, brother. Tyler the Boss Williams. I Run These Streets, Ivan Para. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, Big Papa Slop, Dan Leopold, Happy New Year, brother. The Bakersfield Big Shot, Steve Heredia, and indeed even awesome, Ian Martin. Also, total debacle, Nathan Johnson, whose girlfriend Jessica is celebrating a birthday today. I also hear that she is a big Jeff Hardy fan. Jeff Hardy, still a ladies' man, apparently, after all these years. Nathan is lucky that Jeff is a married man, or else Nathan would be a single man. So happy birthday to Jessica. Project Zero Mortals, Wayne Ashanti. Shout out to his lovely lady, Coral Valentine. I hear she's a fan of the show now as well. How about the Divine Daisy as her nickname? I like that. I was thinking, what kind of nickname can I give her? The Divine Daisy. I was going to say the Divine Diva, but Diva has such a negative connotation. We don't want to get negative here. So thank you to her for being a fan. And last but certainly not least, Belt fan Brent Banner. This week on How Did We Even Get Here, which is the podcast that he and his co-host Trey host every week, they discuss why WWE 2K19 is better than 2K20. I mean, that's not really a stretch. But they're going to talk about that, Brent's dating woes and Trey's possible growing family. I know some of you have picked up on that podcast and have become listeners, which is very cool to hear. New episodes drop every Thursday on all platforms. To find your favorite one, visit their Linktree at linktree.com/gethearpod. It's actually linktr.ee. I don't know why they have that separation in the name, but there it is. linktr.ee/gethearpod. Monday night, WWE hosted Legends Night on Monday Night Raw. This was their big answer to their recent ratings woes. The ratings have never been lower for Monday Night Raw. And you can blame whatever you want. You can blame Monday Night Football. You can blame, you know, all the news, the crush of news that there's been. There's always some excuse that people love to throw out there for why the Raw ratings are just a little bit worse than they were the year before. So what do? They dust off the legends. Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair host Legends Night. And they advertised all these names. Apparently they false advertised some names as well, which we'll get into here. But every time they do one of these Legends Nights, Raw reunion, whatever they want to call it, it is worse than the one that came before it. And one of the reasons for that is that they treat their legends like dog shit. And nobody wants to see that. Nobody wants to see the people they watched when they were kids get treated like a bunch of old geezers. And a bunch of one-dimensional characters that really, they don't do anything. They just kind of spit out a catchphrase, wear their old gear, stand there, and they don't do anything. Nobody wants to see that. Nobody wants to see the legends get shit on and berated. Because WWE is all about heat. Always with this company, it is always about heat. Always about getting heat on somebody. And if it was some young star they were trying to kind of give the rub to, then, you know, that might be one thing. But this time around, it was Randy Orton. I don't think he needs any more heat. Nobody wants to see Ric Flair berated by Randy Orton and then berated by his own daughter on the same show. They always do this. They constantly shit on their legends. How is it that AEW can get it right with the legends and WWE can't? WWE's been doing this a lot longer than AEW has. How come they can get it right with those guys, but not them? You know, AEW has Jake the Snake Roberts. The worst thing you could say about their use of Jake the Snake Roberts is that he's barely on television. And they need to be finding more things for Lance Archer to do. That's a valid criticism. But you know what? When Jake is out there or they do some kind of pre-tape with him and he's cutting a promo, man, that's what makes Jake the Snake, Jake the Snake. He's still got it. They've got Jake the Snake Roberts. They've got Arn Anderson out there as Cody's coach. They've got Tully Blanchard out there cutting promos, better promos than FTR can cut. He's cutting the promos for them because that's his forte. That's his strong suit. That's what he does best. Taz, same thing, great talker, comes out there, Team Taz, he's put this great collection of talent together, he's going to try to help get them over by doing the talking for them, and when he's not doing the talking for them, he's on commentary on Dark doing a great job with Excalibur. They know how to use Taz. I don't know what they're doing with Sting yet. The jury is still out on that one. They don't send them out there and then talk about how pathetic they are. And put them down week after week after week. They find ways for them to enhance the people that they are working with on promos or at ringside during their matches. They contribute to the product. They're treated with respect. Why is that so difficult for WWE? There was no reason to fly those people in for that show on Monday night. Other than a payday, so at least they got that, I hope. Several names were advertised for the show that did not appear. Kurt Angle was not there. Mick Foley, I know he just got over a bout with COVID. He was apparently on lockdown in a hotel. I feel bad for him because he's Mr. Christmas. He gets all, you know, dressed up like Santa Claus every year. Christmas is, I mean, that's like his WrestleMania. And he's big on that and big on spending it with his family. And he had to spend his Christmas and New Year's alone on a COVID lockdown in a hotel somewhere. That probably was worse than any symptom he may have had. So hopefully he's doing better now. But he wasn't there. Carlito and Candice Michelle apparently were never even booked, even though they were advertised. So I have no idea how that happened. Obviously there was a miscommunication somewhere. I don't know what the hell that Hulk Hogan phone segment was at the beginning of the show, but he did pose later on with Drew McIntyre, so we got that. The opening segment on this show with The Miz and Morrison in the ring was the stuff of nightmares. Absolutely channel-changing heat they have with me. That whole correct thing that they do now, correct, that's their new thing. That's The Miz's new slogan. That needs to go die in a fire. Someone tell Randy Orton. He'll take care of it. Absolutely obnoxious to the point that I can't even watch it. Cannot even stomach it. Speaking of Orton, you would think that they would open the show with a resolution to the big cliffhanger from the week before. Did he or did he not set Alexa Bliss on fire? That seems like a pretty important question. But they waited until half an hour into the show to let us know that, in fact, Alexa Bliss is alive and well. Randy Orton just could not bring himself to set this woman on fire. That's nice. Orton spent the entire night berating different legends in the back and teasing violence against them that he never delivered on. He talked a big talk. He didn't actually do anything. And there was never any payoff to it. He insulted the Big Show. He insulted Ric Flair. He insulted Mark Henry. Then he wrestled Jeff Hardy. He beat him with an RKO, and that was it. I'll get back to this in a minute. We had Lacey Evans and Peyton Royce. They got a win over Charlotte and Asuka, non-title, but they got a win over the Women's Tag Team Champions after Lacey Evans flirted at ringside with Ric Flair, who was out there. He came to the ring with his daughter, and then he accidentally tripped Charlotte when she hit the ropes for a big move. That ended up costing her the match. She got up in her father's face afterwards. She berated him, embarrassed him, emasculated him, demanded that he stay out of her business. And he just sheepishly nodded and agreed and said, okay, and then he went and walked off. It was the saddest, most pathetic thing that you've ever seen. So I guess Charlotte is a heel again. No idea if this served any purpose. I mean, maybe she was never really a babyface, but certainly since she came back, teaming with Asuka, who is a babyface, that's how she's been positioned. And now I guess we're just supposed to be reminded of the fact that this woman is a bitch, right? I guess that's what we're supposed to get out of this, and she's not to be liked. She's very unlikable. I have no idea if this served any other purpose other than just getting people to hate Charlotte again, but they could not have made Ric Flair, who I'm sure was more than willing to do it because it's to benefit his daughter, and so he'll do whatever they ask him to do, but it could not have made this man, aside from when he was buried in the desert by WCW and Vince Russo, I think it was Russo, many years ago, or put in the insane asylum. I don't know that this guy has ever looked more pathetic than he did when this segment was over, when this show was over. Main event had Drew McIntyre pinning Keith Lee with a Claymore kick to retain the WWE Championship. I was hoping they would not pin Keith Lee, but pin him they did. They had a good match, but after the week of wrestling that we had, this didn't stand a chance of cracking the top five best matches of the week. All the legends were seated on stage. They were watching the match. They were clapping when it was over. McIntyre was about to speak when who should walk to the ring but Bill Goldberg, who stormed to the ring and he grabbed the mic and he cut a promo on Drew McIntyre that made absolutely no sense. Talking about how he had no respect. He must look at all the legends and think that, you know, he's better than they ever were. Which is something that has never even been teased with Drew McIntyre. Drew McIntyre always pays respect to people and pays respect to the legends. So if the idea was, well, it wasn't anything he said, but it's what he was thinking. Apparently Goldberg now is a fucking mind reader. Goldberg then challenged him to a match at the Royal Rumble for the championship. McIntyre, then he disrespected the legends. He said that Goldberg isn't the same man he was 20 years ago. Fighting him now would feel like fighting his dad. Goldberg shoved him on his ass, and before he could get up in his face, the show abruptly went off the air because they ran out of time. Apparently the reason that none of this made any sense is because Drew was supposed to cut a promo before Goldberg came out that I guess would have made this make more sense. I mean, I don't see how that would have really helped unless Drew just completely turned heel and started shitting on all the legends, which I don't think is what he would have done. Again, Drew McIntyre has never been one to show disrespect to the legends on TV. In fact, the legends helped him against Randy Orton in their ambulance match a few months ago. But even worse, that the parting shot that people were left with at the end of this show was Goldberg shoving the WWE champion on his ass. Now, Drew did get up. He gave him a headbutt when the show was over. They had to be separated. But nobody saw it, so who cares? Maybe they'll show it on TV this week. What you missed when we went off the air. I don't know, but nobody got to see it. How do you run out of time on a 3-hour show? This show shouldn't even be 3 hours. You're running out of time? 3 hours is not enough? Who's timing these shows? I feel like we've had some issues on a couple of different shows recently. SmackDown 2, where they've run low on time. I don't know who's timing the shows for them. It used to be Gerald Briscoe many years ago. Then it was Billy Kidman. Maybe it still is. How do you run out of time on a 3-hour show? That should never happen. Now, Meltzer says the decision to go with Goldberg was made just 48 hours before the show on Monday night. I could tell. 48 hours of thought was put into what we saw on TV. But here's the kicker. The reason that Vince McMahon supposedly went with Goldberg as Drew's challenger, because he didn't think anybody else was ready for the spot. First of all, I could think of two people right off the top of my head. Sheamus and Keith Lee. Now, if you were looking for a Royal Rumble opponent for Drew, before everybody starts yelling at me, yes, but what about WrestleMania? I'm going to get to that. If you were looking for a Royal Rumble opponent for Drew McIntyre, then it's very simple. What you do is you save the match with Keith Lee instead of blowing it off on TV, come up with some other big main event for Legends Night, and you do the match at the Royal Rumble. Or you go with the triple threat idea that I pitched last week with Sheamus in that match pinning Keith Lee and not Drew McIntyre to win the WWE Championship, because the title can change hands in a triple threat. You can not pin the champion but still win the title. And if they want to further the storyline, you know, obviously Drew and Sheamus are friends. Well, what if he took the title from his friend without actually pinning his friend? What if he pinned Keith Lee instead? And then you can have Drew challenge Sheamus at WrestleMania. You can get that one-on-one match at WrestleMania, and Drew can win the belt back and have a big championship celebration at WrestleMania. Because I assume that they're going to be saving the match with Sheamus for WrestleMania. I mean, that's got to be the match. And that's fine, but if Vince McMahon believes, if he honestly believes that they had nobody else ready to face their champion and that Bill Goldberg is their only option, that is a creative failure. And I will say it again, I said it weeks ago, I'll keep saying it, Vince McMahon needs to resign as the head of creative and let somebody else take the reins. resign and let somebody else take the Roman Reigns and helm this, and you know, their vision, new set of eyes, new ideas for how things should go. I know there's a better chance of me, you know, striking oil in my bathtub or finding One-Eyed Willie's buried treasure in my backyard. But if that's what he believes, then you know what? He needs to look in the mirror and he needs to ask himself, why? Why don't we have somebody ready to credibly challenge this man for the WWE title? Because you have done a terrible, terrible job of building challengers. That's why. There's your answer. It's nobody else's fault. You can't blame injuries. You can't blame NXT. You can't blame Triple H. You can't blame Bruce. He needs to look in the mirror and realize what the problem is here. He's running the show. Everybody else works for him. I mean, is Braun Strowman not available? I mean, Braun Strowman, is he still hurt? I thought his injury wasn't all that serious. Is he not going to be available by January 31st, which is when the Royal Rumble is taking place, the very end of the month? Is he not going to be available by them? I mean, don't tell me they're saving him for a bigger show. That would be an even bigger failure. But the silver lining in this is that it hopefully means no match for Goldberg with Roman Reigns or WrestleMania. I have no issue with Goldberg having... Let me make this very clear. My issue is not that Goldberg is wrestling at the Royal Rumble, right? If Goldberg, he's a big name, right, in their eyes, they want to use him on that show, they want to put him in the Rumble as long as he doesn't fucking win, then go ahead, use Bill Goldberg. They're contracted to for the next couple of years, at least two matches a year. So you're going to get Bill Goldberg whether you like it or not. I don't have an issue with having a match for Goldberg on the show. I don't understand why it has to be a championship match. We have already seen Universal Champion Bill Goldberg. They've already gone down that road. But as long as it keeps him away from Roman Reigns in 3 months, then so be it. This should be nothing but a win for Drew McIntyre with the Claymore kick. Goldberg, here, I'm going to map it out for you right now. The match ain't going to go very long. Okay, we know that. Nor should it. Bill Goldberg tries to get him up for the jackhammer, but he can't do it. He can't do it, and don't let him do it, because he could barely get the Fiend up for it, and then he almost killed the Undertaker. Drew McIntyre is no small man. The Goldberg of 20 years ago could jackhammer the Giant. Those days are over. So he tries, but maybe Drew falls behind him instead. One Claymore kick. You know what? Let's give Goldberg the kick out. We got to make Goldberg save face here because he's going to lose. So he kicks out of the Claymore kick. But then they could set up a cool spot maybe where Goldberg goes for a spear. Maybe it's the third one. And he runs right into a Claymore. They have to time it perfectly, but he just runs right into a Claymore kick. And Drew McIntyre pins him. That's it. That's all you need to do. And Goldberg, after the match is over, shakes his hand and says, "You the man. You the man. I was wrong about you. You know what? You are everything you say you are. I'm going to shake your hand. I respect you." Because if they have Bill Goldberg pin Drew McIntyre in the middle of that ring at the Royal Rumble with a fucking jackhammer, I might just spontaneously combust on YouTube that night. But here's my other issue with this. I tweeted this earlier in the week. Considering how Randy Orton, I said I was going to get back to him. Randy Orton spent the entire show on Monday night disrespecting legend after legend after legend backstage, from The Big Show to Ric Flair to Mark Henry. The same Randy Orton who put on night vision goggles, okay, to beat up the legends a few months ago. Let us not forget that. It would have made far more sense if, let's say, Edge is not yet ready to come back in time for the Rumble. And frankly, even if he is, you could still do this. It would have made far more sense to have headlined the Legends show on Monday night, not with the WWE title match, which is fine because they've had shows before where the championship match doesn't headline at the very end. Sometimes it headlines the 9 p.m. hour, top of the 10 p.m. hour. So you don't main event with that, but you headline with Randy Orton, who is in so many different segments on this show anyway. It seemed like it was building to that. Randy Orton in the main event one-on-one against Jeff Hardy. And Jeff Hardy maybe is in there trying to sort of defend the honor of the legends that this guy has badgered all night long. He falls short. Randy Orton beats him. And maybe he's about to do something. Maybe he's teasing that he's going to set Jeff Hardy on fire. And out comes Bill Goldberg to confront Randy Orton and set up a match between the two of them for the Royal Rumble. That way you get Goldberg on the card in a match that he hasn't been in. I mean, I don't think he's wrestled Randy Orton since 2003. He probably had some kind of match with Randy Orton when Orton was in Evolution. Better yet, it's not for a championship. But it makes sense based on the story that they themselves told on Monday night throughout the entire show that had no payoff. Goldberg would interrupt Orton at the end, confront him, challenge him to a match. That is how you do it. Why is this so hard? I shouldn't have to do their job for them. They pay people to do this sort of thing. I'm doing this for free for these guys. Enough about Raw. Let me ask you all a question. How did you choose which internet service providers to use? Sad thing is, most of us have very little choice because ISPs operate like monopolies in the regions that they serve. Then they use this monopoly power to take advantage of customers through data caps and streaming throttles. The list goes on and on. Worst of all, many ISPs log your internet activity and sell that data to other big tech companies or advertisers. To prevent ISPs from seeing my internet activity, I protect all of my devices with ExpressVPN. So what is ExpressVPN? Well, I'm glad you asked. It's a simple app for your computer or your smartphone that encrypts all of your network data and tunnels it through a secure VPN server so that your ISP cannot see any of your activity. Just think about how much of your life is on the internet. Every site you visit, every video you watch, message you send, gets tracked by ISPs or other tech giants who can then sell your information for profit. That's the reason I recommend ExpressVPN as the best way to hide your online activity from your ISP. You just download the app, tap one button on your device, and you're protected. And ExpressVPN does all of this without slowing your connection. That's why it's rated the number one VPN service by CNET and Wired. So stop handing over your personal data to ISPs who mine your activity and sell off your information. Protect yourself with the VPN that I trust to keep me private online. Visit expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster to get 3 extra months free. Go to expressvpn.com/solomonster right now to learn more. It was only a few weeks ago that Shinsuke Nakamura lost to Otis in a 3-minute match on SmackDown. On Friday, he nearly ran the gauntlet to challenge Roman Reigns for the Universal Championship at the Royal Rumble. A gauntlet match was made involving Nakamura, King Corbin, Sami Zayn, Rey Mysterio, and Daniel Bryan. And an angry Roman Reigns called Adam Pearce to the ring, angry that as the champion, he was not given the respect of being able to choose his own opponent. He felt betrayed by Pierce. Roman was on his A game here, as he has been really on these promos since turning heel. And all of this led to Pierce, against his will, being added to the gauntlet match. Now, Pierce has been acting as something of a commissioner on the... You've heard me call him Commissioner Pierce. He's never been given any kind of official title other than WWE official. He just sort of became the de facto authority figure on these shows. And I think he's done a very good job with it. This has been going on now for months. And it's a role that he's been good in. It's one that he's not unfamiliar with. Many years ago, in Ring of Honor, he was Jim Cornette's lieutenant commissioner for a while in storyline. My first exposure to Adam Pearce, just to take this back to the ROH days, my first exposure to Adam Pearce and who he was when the crowd would yell Repo Man at him, because he looked a lot like Barry Darso, or at least that's what a lot of people thought, right? The bald head, the body type, they thought he looked like Barry Darso. And so one night at the Manhattan Center, he pulled out a Repo Man eye mask, because people have been calling him this for months. And so to play along, I think it was some kind of like multi-person match or tag match or something, but he pulled the Repo Man mask out from his tights and put it on. It was very brief, and then he took it off. But he put that thing on and everybody popped. And that's my biggest memory of Adam Pearce from those Ring of Honor days. Last week, I said that they really need to explain to the viewers how and why Sonya Deville is back after losing to Mandy Rose at SummerSlam with that loser leaves WWE stipulation. And this week, she began in a new role as Adam Pearce's assistant, which is good. So she's not back in the ring yet, but over time, she can work her way back into, you know, storylines and back into the ring. Plus, I just have a feeling that she's going to really excel in this role. I don't know that people expected AJ Lee, for example, to be as good as she was when she was in a similar role many years ago, and she killed it. And I think Sonya could do very well in this role, too, because character-wise, she was doing the best work of her career before she went away. So if she's not in the ring right now, but she's going to be doing character-driven stuff behind the scenes, I think she'll excel. Big E and Apollo Crews, they wrestled to a double pin in their Intercontinental Championship match. Big E was willing to accept that outcome, apparently. Apollo was not happy, and Big E's like, hey, that's the way it goes. And he went to go shake the guy's hand, and Apollo smacked the taste right out of his mouth, which led to the match being restarted, and Big E went into beast mode, which is what I like to see. So it wasn't a very long match. It was good for the time it lasted. Big E retained the title. There was a great segment on Talking Smack. I'm sounding like a broken record when I talk about great segments on Talking Smack with Paul Heyman, because now he's on the show every week at the desk with Caleb Braxton. And he sat there next to Apollo Crews, and this was like a 3-minute or 3.5-minute segment where Apollo didn't say anything. Apollo just sat there and looked at him and listened. And Heyman put this guy over like $1 million, and by the end of it, you could see Apollo seething. So I don't think this is the end of this at all. I don't know if that means Apollo's going heel or what, but this issue with him and Big E, based on that segment, clearly is not over. Now, as I predicted last week, I wonder if that counts as my first correct prediction of 2021. Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode beat the Street Profits to become the new SmackDown Tag Team Champions. They have no other team. So how do you try to keep things interesting? Well, by having the babyface team chase for the titles. I mean, the minute I saw that they gave these two guys a new name, or they were going around with that Dirty Dogs thing, I knew those titles were changing. That, coupled with the fact that they have no fucking teams. So, if they beat Roode and Ziggler, then what was next? Unless Jimmy Uso is imminently coming back and they're going to vault them right into a tag team feud with the Street Profits, there are no other obvious opponents and challengers for the Street Profits right now. And so they exploited Montez Ford's knee injury. They had worked over his knee the week before. That came into play in this match. It was too much for him to overcome, and we have new tag team champions. Meanwhile, Paul Heyman tells Adam Pearce that he pulled some strings, and he got him added to the gauntlet at the end of the show. Now, Adam Pearce did not look thrilled. He has not wrestled a match since the last time that Adam Pearce stepped in the ring for a match was the same year that the WWE Network launched. So that's a whole bunch of years ago. But Heyman said, look, now you've got a chance to fulfill your dream. You know, Adam Pearce never wrestled in WWE as a big-time star. He did briefly as kind of an enhancement guy, but he goes, now you have a chance to fulfill your dream of wrestling in the WWE. That's how they were sort of positioning this whole thing. So we get to the gauntlet, and it's Rey Mysterio and Sami Zayn to start. Zayn's cutting a promo when he gets, the bell rings, and Rey immediately attacks, 619, frog splash. And that's it. 1, 2, 3, and Sami Zayn is gone. Thanks for coming. Shinsuke Nakamura was out next. He eliminates Rey Mysterio, which brought out Baron Corbin. I'm still waiting on those Tropicana Field pigeons to do their thing, but they're very patient. They sit there and they watch. Maybe they're waiting for the Royal Rumble so they can hit multiple targets and not just one. Nakamura eliminated Corbin, and that brought out Daniel Bryan. And it may not feel as special as it would have 4 or 5 years ago, but it's still pretty cool, I guess, to see these two in the ring one-on-one like this. That's all on WWE, by the way that they have just marginalized Nakamura. And Nakamura bears some of the responsibility for that as well, because I wasn't overly thrilled by, you know, some of the matches he was having even a few years ago. And I don't want to say he was being lazy. I mean, it's just a matter of, I don't know if it wasn't a case of him caring or just being happy to be there or what it was. He does get some of the blame for that, but the bottom line is that the way that this guy has been booked and positioned for a long time now, it is very bizarre all of a sudden to see him getting a big push. I mean, I'll take it if they're going to be serious about this, at least for a while, but again, you look at his booking up to this point, it's like, boy, it would have been nice for you to at least kind of build to this moment. They didn't bother doing that at all. This guy lost to Otis in a 3-minute match like he was a fucking job guy a few weeks ago. And it's not like they've done anything with Otis since. They're just building him up for the Royal Rumble match and like a comedy spot. But it is still cool when they're in there one-on-one to see Nakamura and Bryan, you know, as much as they respect each other, and Nakamura came to WWE largely to wrestle Daniel Bryan, who unfortunately was retiring at that point. To see them in the ring together is still pretty cool. I was stunned when Nakamura pinned him clean. This seemed like it was tailor-made, if not for a Bryan win, and I'm glad he didn't, it was tailor-made for him to be screwed in the end. I was rooting against a Bryan win because that would have meant they changed their minds and took him out of the Royal Rumble match. But if he gets screwed out of a win by Roman and company, that adds fuel to the fire for him to win the Rumble and challenge Roman for the championship at WrestleMania. So I was stunned that he went out here, and even more surprised when he reached his hand out to Nakamura after, and Nakamura returned his hand and accepted his gesture. This was a total babyface effort on this show by Shinsuke Nakamura. This felt like a babyface turn, and in fact, I think that's exactly what it was. So Roman and Jey Uso are out there, and they lay out Nakamura. They beat this guy down. Here comes Adam Pearce. Adam Pearce is wearing a WWE jacket. He's wearing black pants. He's got jogging pants on, it looks like, a pair of sneakers. Breaking the golden rule of wrestlers, which is always pack your gear bag because you never know when you may get called upon to go to work. So he just took whatever clothing he could find. Roman and Jey, they've left Nakamura for dead. And in the ring, Uso delivers a super kick to Adam Pearce, who collapses in a heap. They drag Adam Pearce on top of Nakamura, and they force the referee to count the 1-2-3. And Adam Pearce will now challenge for the Universal Championship at the Royal Rumble. Adam Pearce challenges for one title at the Rumble. Bill Goldberg challenges for the other. I don't know what that says about WWE creative right now, other than it's not good. Although I do like this story they're telling, but just the fact that those are your two championship challengers at the Royal Rumble here in 2021. One guy who is, what Goldberg, 54 years old, right? Coming in out of nowhere to challenge Drew McIntyre under the pretense that he's been disrespectful to the legends, which makes no sense. And then Adam Pearce, who hasn't wrestled a match in 6 years. These are your two title contenders at this moment. I do think that's going to change, but at this moment, these are your two challengers for the Royal Rumble. But Roman Reigns, the story here is that Roman Reigns wanted a night off at the Royal Rumble. He wanted an easy night, an early night. Now he's got it. The last time Adam Pearce wrestled on WWE television was on Shotgun Saturday Night in 1997. He had a match against Tiger Ali Singh. And now he is challenging for the Universal title at the Royal Rumble. Or is he? Like that little cliffhanger there. Or is he? I don't think he is. Kevin Owens was not on the show this week. Kevin Owens was out selling the bump from the stands the week before when he got put down through two tables, took that big bump. The Kevin Owens story is not over. Now, does that mean that he's going to win the Royal Rumble after getting his ass kicked for weeks on end by Roman Reigns and Jey Uso, that they have pivoted and they have decided that Kevin Owens is going to get the big babyface win at the Royal Rumble and go on to finally beat Roman Reigns for the championship at WrestleMania? It's not what I would do, but I mean, this is a guy who has been overlooked by the company for a very long time. I think they take him for granted, which is why each of the last 2 years around draft time, we have Kevin Owens interviews talking about how he's looking forward to switching back to the other brand because he'll get a fresh start. Every year, it's a fucking fresh start for this guy because they don't know what the fuck to do with him. Now, I don't think, though, that that is what WWE has in mind. I think Kevin Owens is wrestling Roman Reigns at the Royal Rumble. We've got 3 weeks until this pay-per-view. A lot can happen in 3 weeks. Adam Pearce is an authority figure, is he not? He has the power to make matches on these shows. So what is to stop him from taking himself out of the match and having Kevin Owens take his place? What is to stop him, if he can't do that for some reason, from adding Kevin Owens to the match and making it a triple threat? What is stopping him from making himself an enforcer at ringside to make sure that Jey Uso doesn't get involved? Remember I floated the shark cage stipulation a few weeks ago? I said this is eerily very similar to the match that Kevin Owens had at the Royal Rumble in 2017 with Roman Reigns for the Universal title. Only the roles were reversed at the time. Owens was the champion and not Roman. But they had Chris Jericho hanging above the ring in a shark cage because he was always getting involved in Kevin Owens' matches. So to neutralize him, they put him in a shark cage above the ring so he couldn't get involved. I thought maybe they were going to do the same thing with Jey Uso. Maybe they're basically going to do that, only without the shark cage, and instead it'll be Pierce at ringside to try to neutralize Jey Uso should he try to get involved in the match, because he's always interfering. They need somebody who can stop him. That's where Adam Pearce maybe comes into play. And at the Rumble, he even has the chance to get physical, and I was going to say get a big pop, but it's weird for me to say that because there's no fucking fans in the building. If there were fans in the building, he'd get a big pop for throwing a punch or hitting Jey Uso with some kind of big move. That's really all he needs to do. But I think the match is ultimately going to end up being Reigns against Owens, and Reigns is going to win again. So then we have Nakamura. He was screwed out of a championship match. WWE has already announced that he is going to be facing Jey Uso one-on-one on SmackDown this Friday. There is a reason that this man went all the way to the end of that gauntlet instead of Daniel Bryan. I think it was done that way by design. That was not an accident. I could see the Royal Rumble match coming down to Daniel Bryan and Shinsuke Nakamura. I know Sami Zayn was kind of teasing Bryan backstage a few weeks ago, and I was kind of thinking maybe it would come down to Bryan and Sami. Yeah, maybe they even do some kind of spot where people think Sami is eliminated, but he's not, and then Bryan's the last guy, but then Sami comes back. They could do something with him and Zayn, but now I'm having a different idea, which is, what if it were to come down to Bryan and Nakamura, with Bryan winning the Rumble and going on to WrestleMania, and instead Shinsuke Nakamura gets a championship match against Roman Reigns before WrestleMania at the Elimination Chamber, with the tease that if Nakamura wins, we would get Nakamura defending the title one-on-one against Daniel Bryan in the main event of WrestleMania. But instead, of course, he's just another body for Roman to beat on his way to WrestleMania. But I think that's why they turned him on Friday. They needed another babyface after Owens to kind of plug in there against Roman Reigns. Now, if only they had put more thought into rehabbing him before this, to where it didn't just feel like it was totally out of left field, but I guess that's too much to ask for the people on this show. But that's my two cents on how I kind of see this all shaking out. All roads should lead to Bryan and Roman at WrestleMania, not Bill Goldberg and Roman Reigns. Then we have the news that two stars from NXT are expected to be called up to the main roster, called down to the main roster, any week now. Damian Priest, who lost to Karrion Kross at New Year's Evil, and Rhea Ripley, who lost to Raquel Gonzalez. May the wrestling gods have mercy on their souls in a way that they did not for Aleister Black and Ricochet. Per WrestleVotes, and this has since been backed up by The Observer with some additional details, Damian Priest was at one point scheduled to debut on the New Year's Day edition of SmackDown, and he was going to debut as a friend, an ally, of Kevin Owens to kind of back him up and help him against Roman Reigns and Jey Uso. And it's been said that Kevin Owens was the one who objected to the idea, not because he has anything against Damian Priest, but because the idea makes no sense. And he's right, it doesn't. Why would Kevin Owens be friends with Damian Priest? Kevin Owens has no friends. That is why nobody helps him. He cannot be trusted. He betrays everyone. You know, that and what the fuck do Kevin Owens and Damian Priest have in common? They're slender physiques. I mean, what is it that these two have in common? Roman Reigns apparently agreed with Owens that it wasn't the right... It just didn't make sense. He felt it wasn't the right time to introduce someone new into the story who didn't fit. And so the plan was dropped. And now it sounds like Priest is scheduled to debut any week now on the Raw roster and not SmackDown. So he's got Roman Reigns and Kevin Owens to thank for that if he goes to Raw and not SmackDown. Then there's Rhea Ripley. No word on where she's landing. I think it should be the Raw brand. I know it's like throwing her to the lions, but it should be the Raw brand. If we're looking at this objectively, forget about the quality of the shows. If we're looking at this objectively, if we're looking at the rosters, Raw is the place that needs her the most. That division is a mess. Outside of Asuka and Charlotte, we don't know when or if Becky is going to be back. That division is a mess. They need all the help they can get. So it got me thinking about any viable options for the Raw brand in the Women's Royal Rumble match. Because you've heard me talk about this. My top picks or likeliest picks for the Women's Rumble all come from the SmackDown brand. Now, I thought maybe Sonya was going to be in that mix. Doesn't look like it. So we're really looking at two people, Bianca Belair or Bayley, both of whom come from SmackDown. When I look at the Raw Women's roster as it is currently constructed, are there any viable options, realistic options for winning the Women's Royal Rumble match? I guess if Charlotte is in there, then there's always a possibility. But no, I don't really see any. But what if Rhea Ripley goes to Raw? What if she goes to Raw and she wins the Women's Rumble? Charlotte then takes the Raw Women's title from Asuka, not at WrestleMania, but sometime before then. Maybe even at the Royal Rumble. Maybe they have a match. Maybe this whole thing with her treating Ric Flair like shit is going to lead to some segment on Raw tomorrow night where Asuka gets up in her face and confronts her about the way that she treated her father, and that starts friction between the two of them, and it leads to a match. Even though they're the tag team champions, I mean, we've seen this before, friction between tag team champions. Wouldn't be the first time. What if they have a match at the Royal Rumble or the Elimination Chamber or sometime before WrestleMania and Charlotte Flair wins the Raw Women's title from Asuka? And then Rhea Ripley challenges Charlotte for the title at WrestleMania in a rematch from last year's show to avenge her loss. I mean, Bianca Belair can still find her way into the SmackDown Women's title match at WrestleMania against Sasha Banks, which she should. You know, she and Bayley can have a singles match at the Chamber show to determine who goes on to Mania. You could always do that. I would prefer to see Bianca Belair win the Rumble, but if it was going to be Rhea Ripley, you wouldn't hear a complaint out of me. That could then kind of bring that whole story full circle where it's like, I'm back. You know, I lost. Here's a woman who lost to Charlotte, and it was all downhill from there for Rhea Ripley. She didn't have a great year. And it really all stems from that loss to Charlotte at WrestleMania when she lost the championship, the NXT Women's title to her. Now we've come full circle. We're right back where we started. And this time it's Rhea challenging Charlotte and she's able to get her win. I could see it going down that way too. NXT had its New Year's Evil show on Wednesday night. I thought it was a very good show. Better than Dynamite as a whole. But none of the matches were as good as that Kenny Omega Rey Fénix match from Dynamite. Not even Balor and O'Reilly. The Fight Pit match was a late scratch due to an injury, either to Tommaso Ciampa or Timothy Thatcher. On TV, they claimed it was an injury to Thatcher. I don't know if that's legit or not. Maybe they just decided to put it off and save it to where they can headline an episode with NXT for it, instead of it kind of being lost in the shuffle. Maybe they just realized to set the Fight Pit structure up, it just wasn't going to work on this show, and so they bumped it to a different week. I don't know. They have not announced a new date yet. So maybe it is an injury, and they're just waiting to see how that shakes out. So that was kind of a bummer. They also announced the next takeover for Valentine's Day, which could be a sign of them not doing one WrestleMania weekend like they usually do because they like to space these shows out. Although I guess Mania, is Mania, I don't remember if it's April this year or the end of March. If it's April, then maybe they could do another takeover around that time, possibly. But these takeover shows now are on Sundays, so they wouldn't really be able to do one WrestleMania weekend anyway. So anyway, that's going to be the next takeover show. I didn't know if maybe they would go with the St. Valentine's Day Massacre nickname for it, but I guess maybe in these times that's a little touchy if you want to use the Massacre name, so maybe they'll pick a different one. Karrion Kross beat Damian Priest in the send-off for Priest. Send-off or not, this was a match that Kross needed to win. His first match back from the shoulder injury, his first big match back. Not a great match, but the right outcome. And a new finish. He did not use the cross jacket submission. He used a forearm to the back of the head, knocking out Damian Priest. So now, do they have him challenge for the title at the next takeover? For the championship that he never actually lost? Or do they feed him someone else in the interim? You know, Priest is a former North American champion that he just beat pretty convincingly. So I would say you can send him right into the NXT title match next against whoever the champion may be. Santos Escobar retained the Cruiserweight title over Gran Metalik. Fun match. I thought this was one of Escobar's best matches since coming to NXT. Xia Li and Boa made their first appearance in the COVID Coliseum since their cinematic torture sessions began. They had a very elaborate entrance with the mystery woman sitting upon a throne. We could not get a good look at her face. Xia got a quick win over Katrina Cortez, who I believe is the, what was her name? Is it Carolina or Catalina? She appeared on Raw for about 3 weeks with Sin Cara a couple years ago, before she vanished and went back to developmental. Believe that is the same woman. I'm digging the new look for Xia. She looks great. I'm digging the new attitude. I'm digging the entrance and the presentation. I see big things in her future. Boa remains to be seen. We haven't seen him back in the ring yet. But Xia Li, I'm all in for this new Xia Li look and this new Xia Li push. My favorite part of the show was the match between... It was really the match I was looking forward to the most coming in, especially after that outstanding video package they put together the week before. Last Woman Standing, Rhea Ripley and Raquel Gonzalez at Halloween Havoc. They had a great wrestling match, right? Focused in the ring. This was not a wrestling match. This was a fight. These women beat the shit out of each other. This was a brawl with plunder. They brawled all over the building. I wish they would have spent more than 1 week educating people about their friendship. That video package, again, like I said, was just fantastic that they aired the week before. There was a spot where Gonzalez backdropped Rhea onto the edge of the announce desk, and I had a Shawn Michaels Royal Rumble 98 flashback. I hate spots where people land on the edge of something. We saw it actually on Raw this week with Keith Lee, who got powerbombed on the edge of the announce table by Drew McIntyre. You are just asking for trouble when you do that. I very much enjoyed watching Rhea shove Dakota Kai into a... if this locker were 3 feet tall, maybe 4 feet, I'd be shocked. She shoved this woman. This woman is so tiny that she shoved her into a locker and got her in there and locked her inside. I was getting claustrophobic just watching it. She kind of barricaded her in there. They brawled out onto the stage. Raquel chokeslammed Rhea through the stage. Both women went through. Gonzalez crawled out of the hole first before the count of 10. Rhea could not. And so Raquel Gonzalez gets the win. The correct outcome. Rhea already won the first match. She's likely on her way out, as we just talked about. The only outcome that really here that made sense was Gonzalez going over. And she now has pinfall wins over the NXT Women's Champion in the War Games match. And a win here over Rhea Ripley. Now, Mercedes Martinez, she had a little promo on this show talking about Io Shirai. She may be next in line for Io in a title shot because she attacked her recently. But Raquel Gonzalez is your next NXT Women's Champion. It's not going to be Mercedes Martinez. I believe it is going to be, and I believe it should be, Raquel Gonzalez. The stuff with the Garganos, Austin Theory, indie wrestling, as I shall continue to call her. I assume this was just filler to replace the Fight Pit match that got nixed. It led to an impromptu match, Johnny and Candice taking on Kushida and Shotzi Blackheart, with Kushida pinning Johnny. I still believe, said this months ago, I still believe that as much as they have protected Kushida for months, all of those wins were to build for him to challenge Finn Balor for the NXT Championship. But when Balor got hurt and he was out for all those weeks, I think it ruined their plans. And they didn't know what to do with Kushida. And so now he has been slotted in for the North American title against Johnny Gargano, which I am sure he is going to lose when they meet. I'm sure Kushida, for all these wins, is not going to beat Johnny Gargano when they meet, which probably will be on Valentine's Day. And Finn Balor retained his NXT championship over Kyle O'Reilly. I would say this is an excellent match. I would put it a notch below their match from TakeOver 31. If it was any other week, it would have been probably most people's match of the week. It would have been, if not my match of the week, second best match of the week behind Rhea and Raquel, which again, I just enjoyed that more. But in a week with two Wrestle Kingdom shows and that Kenny Omega Rey Fénix match from Dynamite, on my list, this was only sixth or seventh best match of the week, which is the sign of a great week to come in sixth, or for this match to come in number six or number seven. The storytelling here was great with Balor, you know, targeting the jaw, given that O'Reilly broke his jaw. He was trying to pay it back. He wanted to reciprocate, and Balor had a gash above his left eye. Balor locked on a Koji clutch variant. He was applying a cross face to put pressure on the injured jaw. And at the end, Kyle had no choice but to tap out. And Kyle looked very unhappy with himself when the match was over. And even though all the other Undisputed Era members came out to try to cheer him up, it wasn't. He had this really pissed off, disappointed look on his face. Balor was just standing there, blood smeared all over his own face, looking down at Kyle, just looking like a badass. O'Reilly now is a two-time loser, but you know what? Each loss gave him more credibility than the match before. As a headliner, where I think if there were people coming into this feud who didn't really buy into Kyle O'Reilly as being a world champion, they didn't buy into Kyle O'Reilly as being somebody who can main event shows for the brand, I would hope that those people have come around, because I think he's proven those people wrong. Kyle O'Reilly is that good. And even though it didn't work out for him this time, it feels like, you know, unless the whole UE gets called up soon, that we may yet get NXT champion Kyle O'Reilly before 2021 is over. That he may be groomed for that spot. But today is not that day. So, excellent main event to what I thought was a very good show overall. This Wednesday is the kickoff to the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. Here are the teams for this year. Adam Cole and Roderick Strong will be representing Undisputed Era. Johnny Gargano and Austin Theory representing The Way. Marcel Bartel and Fabian Aichner of Imperium. Breezango, Drake Maverick and Killian Dane. The Grizzled Young Veterans. Jake Atlas and Isaiah Swerve Scott are going to be a team. Kushida and Leon Ruff. They are definitely not winning. Ever-Rise. Ever-Rise, you know what? I like Ever-Rise. They would be my dark... They're not my pick, but they would be my dark horse pick. I would love to see them win, just shock everybody and go on to win. I don't expect that to happen, though. The Bollywood Boys are in, as are August Gray, which is just... Sounds like a romance novelist, right? August... The new book from August Gray. Teaming with Kurt Stallion. Yeah, they're not winning either. I guess some of these matches, by the way, are going to be taking place on 205 Live, which is probably why the Bollywood Boys are involved. I'm going to go with the Grizzled Young Veterans. I think that they're in for a big push. I think they're going to take this tournament. I assume that this is going to be over before Valentine's Day. and the winners would then meet the champions, Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch, at TakeOver. This Wednesday, it's Cole and Strong taking on Breezango, and Ever-Rise takes on the Grizzled Young Veterans. So there you go. My pick against my Dark Horse pick. One of them is going to be eliminated after this Wednesday. I suspect that'll be Ever-Rise with the Grizzled Young Vets moving on. They're also going to be doing a women's Dusty Classic for the very first time. They have not announced when. I will say they definitely have the depth in the women's division to pull it off. I assume the winners would then get a shot. They haven't said this, but the winners would get a shot at the WWE women's tag team title, since those titles are supposed to be able to float across brands. And so you could end up with a situation where you have an NXT women's team beating Charlotte and Asuka, right? If the reign of Charlotte and Asuka is going to dissolve and come to an end, maybe they get the belts on a pair of NXT ladies who can then float from brand to brand without officially being called up to the main roster. Maybe that's the best solution here. Keep them in NXT, but let them float from one show to the next to defend their titles without officially being thrown to the main roster. But we don't know when this tournament, I don't think they're going to do them concurrently. So are they going to do it when the first one is over? Are they going to wait 6 months to do it? They haven't told us yet. And with that out of the way, I said at the top of the show that this week's episode is also doubling as the annual Sound Off prediction show, where I look back at what I got right and what I got very wrong in 2020. And I gaze into my crystal ball to see what lies ahead in the world of wrestling in 2021. 2020 was a year like no other. I think it's safe to say it gave us the first ever empty arena WrestleMania. Money in the Bank inside and on top of Titan Tower. It gave us the Thunderdome. It gave us some great things like heel Roman Reigns and the Hurt Business. And not so great things like Retribution and Raw Underground, Goldberg beating the Fiend, Rey Mysterio's fake eyeball. I can go on and on. I was going to say gumball, but that's basically what it was. The list of horrible things is far longer, unfortunately. I don't think anybody could have predicted any of those things. So when I or anybody else did their predictions for 2020, I don't think, well, maybe Goldberg beating the Fiend, but I don't think any of these things would have been on their list. Shout out to Byron from upstate New York for helping track my predictions from last year. These are from Sound Off episode 634. If you want to go back and listen to them all over again, let me run through what I got right and what I got wrong, because unlike other people, I do hold myself accountable for these things. I could just ignore it like it didn't happen and just move on, but figure let's see what I got right and what I got wrong. I predicted that Drew McIntyre would win the Elimination Chamber and go on to beat Brock Lesnar for the WWE title at WrestleMania. So I was half right. I predicted that Roman Reigns would win the Men's Royal Rumble and face The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, for the Universal title at WrestleMania, which definitely did not happen. I predicted that Ronda Rousey would return to win the Women's Royal Rumble match, face Becky Lynch for the Raw Women's title at WrestleMania, and lose. And then Shayna Baszler would attack Becky on Raw the next night, start a program with her, and go on to end the year-long reign of Becky Lynch. It could have gone down that way with Shayna Baszler, but it did not. Nor could I have predicted that Becky would be going away because she would be pregnant. But none of that happened. I predicted that Edge would be a surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble, so that one was right. I predicted John Cena would wrestle the Velveteen Dream at WrestleMania, which maybe in hindsight was a good idea that it didn't happen. But Cena had talked the Dream up a lot on interviews, or some panel maybe it was. He had talked him up before as being somebody that he would love to wrestle, who he saw a big, big future in. And that would have been a great spot for them to make a new star in one night, in one program, if they wanted to. for all the talk about CM Punk possibly coming back at that, and there was a lot of talk at that time about Punk. You know, AEW Dynamite had just debuted on TNT. I predicted that Punk would not wrestle in 2020, which he did not. Nor should he. If he has plans to come back, you cannot have CM Punk come back and wrestle and make his big return unless you have fuller crowds. Maybe not a full crowd, but fuller crowds back in the build. CM Punk is not going to come back to the fucking Thunderdome screens. CM Punk should not be coming back in front of 750 or 1,000 people at Daly's Place. If he's going to come back, then you need to have a full building, make it a surprise, and then boom, out he walks. And he gets either big cheers or big boos. Otherwise, it makes no sense for him to come back right now until they get people back in the buildings. I predicted that The Undertaker would wrestle his final match at Survivor Series, which would be his send-off, 30th anniversary. And he would then headline the Hall of Fame class in 2021. I was sort of right, but not really. He did have his big send-off at the Survivor Series, but it was not in a match. I do think were it not for COVID, though, the Hall of Fame this year probably would have been built around The Undertaker. Instead, they're probably just going to rerun last year's Hall of Fame class because they never got proper inductions. I predicted the WWE would host its first ever Queen of the Ring event, which did not happen, but I still think it should. I predicted that Jon Moxley would beat Chris Jericho to become the new AEW champion at Revolution, and then would drop the title to Kenny Omega at All Out. I was mostly right on this. He did beat Jericho at Revolution. He did drop the title to Kenny Omega later in the year, but it was a few months later on Dynamite. That I would not have predicted. I would not have predicted the title change would happen on free TV. I predicted that Matt Hardy would leave WWE, which he did, on March 1st. I said he would leave for AEW to be revealed as the Exalted One of the Dark Order. AEW went with Brody Lee instead. They do admit that Hardy was under consideration, though, for that role, but they went with Brody instead. I predicted that Marty Scurll would not sign with AEW, but instead would re-sign with Ring of Honor and would be allowed to continue to work with the NWA, which is exactly what happened. And now he is not with either one of those companies. 2020 giveth, 2020 taketh away. I predicted that the Revival would re-sign with WWE, which did not happen. I'm sure they're very happy about that. I predicted that Brody Lee would sign with AEW, which he did. I predicted that Undisputed Era would head to the main roster. Boy, I was happy to be wrong on that one. I predicted that Bianca Belair would be women's champion, but not in NXT. She would either be the champion on Raw or SmackDown. Now, she did get called up. She did not win either title, though. Not yet. But she is well on her way. I predicted that Austin Theory would be the NXT North American champion by the end of the summer. He is aligned right now with the North American champion, but not the champion himself. I predicted 205 Live would end, and yet it lives on for some reason. I predicted that NWA Power would find a way or would find a home on the WWE Network by year's end. I still think there was a decent chance of that happening. There were discussions at one point with, I think, Corgan, Lagana, and WWE. I think the pandemic and I think the Dave Lagana stuff just killed any chance of that happening. But I maintain that there was a pretty decent chance of that happening before the end of last year. I predicted that MLW would land on a name network and would sign Killer Cross. And that Cross would also work dates for New Japan. This was after MLW had signed Jacob Fatu to a new 5-year deal. And I had been told, and I was told this, that they were going to be getting aggressive with more signings. And Cross was kind of either a free agent or he had been trying to get his release from Impact. And he ended up signing with WWE instead. And finally, with the New Japan predictions here, I predicted that Sanada would win the New Japan Cup. And the Cup got delayed due to COVID. And then he lost to Evil in the semifinals, but would then fall short of winning the IWGP championship, but would become the Intercontinental champion by the end of the year. And he did not win either one of those. And I predicted that Kota Ibushi would win the IWGP title from Tetsuya Naito. I was only off by a few days, guys. I mean, I was only off by 4 days. You got to cut me some slack on that one. My other prediction was that Okada would pin Will Ospreay in the finals of the G1. And Okada would go on to challenge Ibushi for the belt in a kind of a role reversal from night one of Wrestle Kingdom the previous year. But this time he would lose. Okada would lose. We did get to see Ibushi beat Naito and Okada beat Ospreay. Just happened on the same night in the first week of 2021. So what is that? 7 out of 22, I think? I've had better years. Let's see if we can rebound in 2021. Here are my predictions for 2021. The lows keep getting lower every year. From Monday Night Raw, you hear me say it every year. The lows keep getting lower. And this year will be no different. I predict that Raw will see its lowest ratings ever, bottoming out at 1.3 million viewers. I think that's their base, that they will just simply not dip below, at least not this year. And it won't be for any long stretch of time, but things are going to get bad again at some point, and I believe that 1.3 is going to be the low point that they hit this year. I predict that Daniel Bryan will win the Men's Royal Rumble match, but will fall short in his quest to become Universal Champion against Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. As far as the Women's Royal Rumble is concerned, you've heard me talk about Bianca Belair, how I think she should go on to win and then challenge Sasha Banks at WrestleMania. But these are predictions, though, and not hopes. That's what I hope happens. That's what I'm kind of leaning towards happening. But I have a different idea in mind as far as what I actually predict is going to happen. And it's what I was just talking about a few minutes ago. I predict that Rhea Ripley will debut on the Raw brand, and she will win the Women's Royal Rumble match while Charlotte Flair takes the Raw Women's title from Asuka, either at the Rumble or the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. That paved the way for Rhea to challenge Charlotte in a rematch from last year's WrestleMania, where she lost. This time, they make it to Raymond James Stadium. If Raymond James Stadium is going to be where they host WrestleMania this year, and we don't know that yet, it's not official, but I think they'll make it back there, and this time Ripley avenges that loss, and she wins the championship from Charlotte Flair. I predict that Edge will wrestle AJ Styles at SummerSlam. I'll just be happy for it to be someone other than Randy Orton. And by the time they get to the match, I'll make another prediction. AJ will no longer have a bodyguard. Omos will be Nomos. I predict that Ricochet, if he knows what's good for him, will be the next WWE name to leave for AEW. And look, I don't know when the contract for Aleister Black is up. If it is this year, then he's as good as gone too. And that probably isn't a very bold prediction considering A, what they've done with him, and B, what happened with his wife. But if his contract is up this year, he's got to get the hell out of there. And I think he will. The sooner the better. It is an absolute disgrace what that company has done with him, or the lack of what they have done with him. It is an absolute disgrace. And they do not deserve to have him on that roster. I predict that USA Network will move NXT off of Wednesday nights, where it is dying a death most weeks against AEW. NXT could easily be pulling in 150,000 to 200,000 more viewers each week and getting those demos up, which the oh-so-important demos, if they just switch nights, if they just move to a different night. Vince McMahon may not want to make the move because he doesn't want AEW to run unopposed. And if you don't think so, then you're a fool. But he's not going to have final say, and I predict that USA will get NXT moved to Thursday nights at some point this year. Now, some of this is obviously predicated on the world climbing out of the pandemic enough, we're not going to be totally out of it, but if we can climb out of the pandemic enough to at least relax some of the travel restrictions, I do believe at some point this year that AEW and New Japan Pro Wrestling will work together. The forbidden portal shall be opened. I predict that Kenny Omega will wrestle and defeat Jon Moxley in a rematch at Revolution next month. And while the working relationship is going to continue between AEW and Impact Wrestling, Omega will not win the Impact World title from Rich Swann, but he will win the NWA World's Heavyweight Championship, I believe, from Nick Aldis to add to his collection. I also don't think that the NWA is going to survive the year. And it pains me to say that, but it's just the feeling I have. Every few weeks, it feels like it brings news of another departure. The most recent one was now the referees are leaving, or not being renewed. Referee Brian Hebner no longer under contract to the NWA. We've heard of Zicky Dice and Marty Bell, among other names that are no longer there. They have no major shows. I know they have their new Shockwave show, but there's no return of Power being talked about, big pay-per-views or anything. No major shows on the horizon due to the pandemic. I just don't think it looks good at all for the NWA. I predict that Adam Hangman Page will win the AEW World Championship from Kenny Omega at Full Gear in November. The same event where he lost last year to Omega in the world title eliminator and will become the first man in AEW. I know some people have kicked out of it before in Japan, but he will become the first man in AEW to kick out of the One-Winged Angel. I predict Sting will wrestle a total of 3 cinematic matches in 2021, teaming with Darby Allin against Team Taz, a singles match with Chris Jericho, and a singles match with Cody Rhodes. I predict that Britt Baker will be your next AEW Women's Champion, and Thunder Rosa, who will end up working for AEW full-time when the NWA pretty much is either done or almost done, Thunder Rosa will be the one to take that title from Britt Baker. I predict that Penta and Rey Fénix will hold AEW gold in 2021, but it will be in the form of Trios gold as part of Death Triangle with Pac after AEW introduces Trios tag team titles. I predict that Jungle Boy, now with his old Tarzan Boy theme song that Tony Khan just bought the rights to, will have a breakout year as a single star, and he will become the TNT champion. And when they get big crowds back in the buildings again, which I don't think will be until 2022, I'm sorry, but that's what I think. But when that happens, his entrance is going to turn him into an even bigger star. You know, someone mentioned to me Grado's old entrance, when he would come out, like in ICW, he'd come out to Like a Prayer by Madonna. Picture an entrance like that here in this country, but in front of 5,000 or 10,000 people. But again, the crowds, I think we're looking at next year. I mean, they've got some crowds now. They had more people than ever, I think, in the building for the Brody Lee tribute show. They had about 1,000 or a little over 1,000. And that's, I think, the biggest they've done. But, you know, when I talk about crowds, I'm talking crowds like we had before. And I just don't see that happening this year. It's going to be some time, unfortunately, before we get back to that. I predict that Miro, once this best man stuff has run its course, will take the TNT title. And the only question is, does he take it from Darby Allin? Or does he take it from Jungle Boy, if my other prediction is right? I predict that Wardlow will also be one of the breakout stars in AEW this year once he splits away from MJF as a babyface. I also think before the year is over that Sammy Guevara will end up as a babyface. Sammy Guevara has a babyface, so at some point he has to end up as a babyface. It only makes sense. The guy looks like he's, you know, 16 years old. I predict that AEW will finally do a blood and guts match before the end of the year. I predict that AEW's second show will finally premiere on Saturdays at 6.05 p.m. The old WCW Saturday night slot, the mothership, as Dusty Rhodes used to say, either on TNT or TBS. I mean, they're both in the same family, so either one would... TBS would make more sense for nostalgia's sake. But, I mean, you know, you got Dynamite airing midweek, right? Dynamite airs right in the middle of the week on Wednesdays. Saturday is probably the likeliest time for a second show. Either way, I mean, if you wanted to put some space between the two, and if Dark stays on Tuesdays on YouTube only, I would think Saturdays probably would make the most sense. I predict that Jay White will stay with New Japan Pro Wrestling and will be the man to take the IWGP United States Championship away from Jon Moxley. It'll be White that does it, not Kenta. White then makes a run to win the G1 Climax, making it all the way to the finals before ultimately losing to Okada. And I predict that Kota Ibushi will remain IWGP champion for the remainder of the year into the beginning of 2022. And Will Ospreay will become Intercontinental Champion once they end this double champion stuff and they separate, not unify, the two titles. And he does so by beating Ibushi. Ibushi said the other day in that presser after his Wrestle Kingdom main event on night two, he said he doesn't mind defending each title separately. He wants to unify them. But if New Japan wants him to defend them separately, then he says he has no problem doing that. So how's this for a prediction? Ibushi loses the IC title to Ospreay. Okada wins the G1, then beats Ibushi to win back the IWGP title at Wrestle Kingdom 16. Which then sets up Will Ospreay to challenge Okada with the idea that Ospreay pinned the IWGP champion, but never won the top title because that title isn't the one that was on the line. And now, if he wants to be the champion, he's got to beat Okada to do it, and Okada is the same man who just beat him at Wrestle Kingdom. Now there's some long-term storytelling, which New Japan usually is very good with. But I guess some of those predictions bleed into 2022. But anyway, that is my look at what I see happening in 2021. You guys let me know what you agree with and disagree with, and I want to know your predictions. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen in the world of wrestling? Bold predictions for 2021. Let me know.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, well, we got a packed one this week. Holy smokes, we got a big week. And we're going to start 29 years ago this week. New Japan Pro Wrestling's annual January 4th Tokyo Dome tradition began. In 1992 with a joint WCW-New Japan Super Show, headlined by Sting and the great Muda against the Steiner Brothers. It wasn't until 2007... that it would be rebranded as Wrestle Kingdom, which has become New Japan's version of WrestleMania every year. It always takes place on January 4th, regardless of what day of the week it might be. And now, of course, it's the last couple of years, it's been two nights back-to-back, January 4th and January 5th. Wrestle Kingdom 12 in 2018 featured an IWGP United States Championship match between the champion Kenny Omega and the challenger, Chris Jericho. Jericho had not wrestled for New Japan since 1997. Been a long time since he had been there in the Tokyo Dome. Don Callis helped broker the deal. He was friends. He is friends with both those guys. He was doing commentary, Callis was, at the time for New Japan. The match did big business for the company. It got them a lot more subscriptions to New Japan World. And Tony Khan, and Jericho talks about this, and I'm sure Jericho loves talking about this. He talks about this almost as much as he talks about being the only man to beat Rock and Stone Cold in the same night. But Tony Khan credits that match as the catalyst for the idea to eventually start what would become All Elite Wrestling. 28 years ago this week, on January 9th, 1993, Bret the Hitman Hart beat Ric Flair to retain the WWF Championship in a 60-minute Iron Man match at the Boston Garden, which Bret won 3-2. A Saturday matinee, part of the first of two double shots they pulled that weekend. Bret pinned Flair later that night in Portland, Maine. And the next day he beat him again in a matinee in Lakeland, Florida. And then later on that night in Orlando. But there was some drama before the Boston match backstage. In his book, Bret says that he came up with what he thought was a good finish for their match. He ran it by Vince McMahon. But then when he went to go tell Ric Flair, Flair started telling Bret what they were going to do instead. And so Bret cut him off, and he chewed him out in front of the locker room, in front of a bunch of the wrestlers that were sitting around, and told him, hey, Ric, I'm the champion. This is how it's going to go. And he says that Flair's jaw dropped, his face turned red, I guess from embarrassment, and he just sat down on a bench, did Flair, and said, you're the champ. He says Flair managed to mess up the timing for every single fall in the match, and Bret was pissed when Dave Meltzer in The Observer said that Flair carried him for the entire match when it was the other way around. Bret hated Flair's routine. Every single match, the Flair flop, the flip over in the corner. He always thought Flair was very overrated. The two of them have never liked each other. If you read their comments in their respective books and other comments they've made about one another, they've worked together plenty of times. They had some really good matches. And maybe today, you know, they're older, maybe they'd be more complimentary of the other. They probably get along okay. It's not like they can't be in the same room together, but you just from their comments, you know that these two have never really liked each other. But I want to read you real quick what Meltzer said in the January 20th, 1993 issue of The Observer, because I had to go see for myself. I mean, did he actually say this? And what did he say that pissed off Bret so much? But this is what he said about the match in The Observer. He said, the match was said to have been a classic. We received 9 reports from the show. 3 of the 9 gave it 5 stars. Another gave it 4.75. Another gave it 4.5. All of whom pretty well indicated that it was the best live match they had ever seen in years. According to one source, Flair thought it was the best match he was involved in during his entire WWF stay. Bobby Heenan made a rare appearance at ringside as a manager. First fall went to Bret in 27 minutes with a rolling reverse cradle. Flair came back to win falls 2 and 3. During the second fall, Heenan distracted the ref and Flair used the chair. Heenan was sent to the back. Flair won fall 2 with a figure 4 and fall 3 with a figure 4. Bret evened it with a sharpshooter. At this point, Heenan showed up again, handed Flair a gimmick, which he hit Hart with twice, but both times Hart kicked out, and when Flair went for the figure 4, Hart cradled him for the 1-2-3 to go up 3-2 with 1.5 minutes left in the match. So I'm not sure where Bret read that or where Meltzer may have said that, but sounds like a pretty positive review to me. There is fan cam video of the match that is out there. At least at one time I know it was on YouTube. If you want to go seek it out, the match never did air on TV. Which is interesting because the WWF title match where Bret won the championship in Saskatoon never aired on TV either. I'm not sure why none of their matches never aired on TV. That one ended up on a Coliseum video. 26 years ago this week, on January 7th, 1995, the WWF was taken by storm by a newcomer, making his debut on WWF Superstars in a match taped 1 month prior, the man himself, or I should say, half man, half tar. Oh yes, that's right. I'm talking about Mantar. Brrr! That's the Mantar bellow. I just debuted a new Mantar Super Chat during our YouTube streams. If you want to hear me do the Mantar bellow. I don't even know why I did that on the New Year's Eve stream. I just happened to let out a Mantar fucking mating call like that. I don't even remember why I did it. So I made it a new Super Chat. I had no idea that this week was the anniversary of his big debut. How's that for timing? The man behind the mask, or headdress, I'm not even sure what you would call it. It was a giant bull's head. The man was Mike Halleck, who had wrestled as Bruiser Mastino before this. Unfortunately for him, he came in at a time when Vince McMahon may have been on some hallucinogenic drugs. I don't know, but 1995 gave us Mantar, King Mabel, and an evil Santa Claus from the South Pole. So, need I say more? He debuted on Superstars against Walter Slow. And he was referred to as the Minotaur. That's how he was announced to the ring. He was called the Minotaur. So I don't know exactly when he got the Mantar name, but he was supposed to be half man, half Minotaur. Jim Ross, bless his heart, tried to explain this on commentary during one of his later squash matches by saying that his name was Mike. So he acknowledged that the guy's name was Mike and that he had been bullied his whole life, hence the bull's head that he would wear to the ring. That is bullshit. But nice try. I know Jim Cornette managed him a couple of times. He thought Bruce Pritchard was ribbing him the first time that Bruce came to him and said, hey, you're going out there with Mantar tonight. But no, he was serious. But by the summer of 95, Mantar was gone. Very sad. They did bring him back, though. Not Mantar, but they brought back Mike Halleck briefly, very briefly, to be a bodyguard the following year for Goldust. And he even bumped for the Ultimate Warrior after Warrior's match with Goldust, if you could even call it that, at the In Your House pay-per-view in April of 96. There was a match, I think it was for the Intercontinental title, it was booked between Goldust and the Ultimate Warrior. And Goldust, I think, had a knee injury, and so he couldn't really work. So they weren't really able to have a match. It was just a lot of stalling and kind of standing around. But I guess Halleck was there, and he took some bumps and got body slammed by the Ultimate Warrior, and that was it. They should have just had him out there in Goldust Corner as Mantar. 23 years ago this week, on January 8th, 1998, the debut episode of WCW Thunder premiered on TBS, a show that Eric Bischoff absolutely did not want to do. A lot of the Turner executives above him did not want to do the show either. They knew that it would be overkill. They knew it would burn out Nitro and the whole WCW product. And they knew also it would create additional work for them and their production team that they really did not need. But it happened because of one man. And it just so happened the one man who wanted the show was the only voice that really mattered. And that was Ted Turner. WCW had such a huge year in 1997. They were riding high. They went from being the black sheep of the Turner Empire to their golden goose. And Turner thought, well, if Nitro is such a success for TNT, then let's replicate that on TBS with Thunder. Now, Bill Burke is a name that you may not be familiar with. Bill Burke was the president of TBS. And so he heard Ted Turner say the same thing. We got to do Thunder. But then Bill Burke went to Eric Bischoff and he made it very clear that we're not paying for it. We, TBS, we are not paying for this show. So you're going to have to find another way to fund this thing. So Turner, I mean, think about it. What Turner basically said was, we want you to do this live 2-hour television show every week, which live television is not inexpensive. It was not inexpensive back then, and it sure as hell isn't inexpensive today. I think I remember reading it was like every episode would cost anywhere from $350,000 to $450,000 per show per week. But I want you to do this show, but we're, you know, you're going to have to find a way to pay for it. That's basically what happened here. Bischoff knew it was going to dilute Nitro, and now he had to go find a way to pay for it, which they didn't have the money to do, so they ended up having to add more house shows to try to offset the cost of the show and raise money to pay for the show. That was an issue, because a lot of the top stars in the company, you know, all the names that you would figure, in their contracts, they had a cap on the maximum number of dates that they can wrestle in a given month or in a given year. So all of a sudden, you're going to have all these live events that you expect people to pay to come see. And what are people going to want to see when they come to these shows? They're going to want to see the names. They're going to want to see the big stars. So they were in a situation where they had to run these shows, and they did not have access to a lot of the top names that people would actually want to pay money to come see. So the whole thing was a disaster. He said, you know, more than anything, this is what Bischoff said, more than anything, more than guaranteed contracts, more than the finger poke of doom, he claims that adding Thunder is ultimately what really gutted WCW. Now, his original idea with Thunder was to do what WWE later tried to do with its own brand split and create two warring brands from within. The NWO would take over Monday Nitro. Remember that I talked about that last week, the NWO Nitro experiment. That was a fucking failure. But that was his original idea. That's why they added so many people to the NWO to the point of absurdity, because his idea was we need a roster of people who will be on the NWO show on Mondays on TNT. So you need all these NWO guys because you need a roster for the show. And then WCW would have taken over the Thunder slot Thursdays on TBS. Well, that was the original plan per Jim Ross that Vince McMahon had in mind for the brand, for the invasion and the brand split in 2001. They were going to give WCW Raw. And WWF would have taken over SmackDown on Thursdays. They were already drawing up creative plans for it when they had the match in Tacoma with Booker T and Buff Bagwell, and Vince McMahon just ended up blowing the whole thing up, and that was the end of that. They did the invasion angle for a few months, and that was it. Probably for the better. But anyway, that was the original plan for Thunder and Nitro that Bischoff had in mind. 22 years ago this week, on January 4th, 1999, one of the biggest nights of the Monday Night War era, a famous night, an infamous night for WCW, on a taped episode of Monday Night Raw, Mankind beat The Rock to win his first WWF championship, which had been taped the week prior. The year prior, technically. Over on TNT, Nitro was a live 3-hour show from the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. And at the order of Eric Bischoff, Tony Schiavone, he gave away the results of the Raw main event, and he bashed Mick Foley. He was mocking his title win, and that sent 600,000 viewers fleeing Nitro over to Raw so they could see a world title change on USA. On Nitro, Goldberg had just seen his undefeated streak ended at Starrcade by Kevin Nash. He had been beaten for the first time. He lost the WCW World Championship. And so tonight was going to be the rematch from Starrcade between Goldberg and Kevin Nash. Nash was the new champion tonight. He admitted that Goldberg got screwed at Starrcade and he was going to defend his title against him in the main event. But when Goldberg got to the building, he was arrested on charges of aggravated stalking that were filed against him by Miss Elizabeth. And so as Goldberg is taken away to the police station, which, keep in mind, is right across the street from the Georgia Dome. Who should make his grand return as Goldberg is being escorted out to the police station? Who should come in but Hollywood Hogan? Hollywood Hulk Hogan making his first appearance since announcing his phony candidacy for President of the United States back on Thanksgiving Day. Hogan cuts a promo on Nitro. He calls Goldberg a sexual deviant. By this point, Hogan was leading the heel wing of the NWO. Nash was leading the cool wing, the red and black, the wolf pack. He says he wants a match with Hogan if Goldberg can't make it back in time for the main event. Nash will defend his title against Hogan if Goldberg cannot make it back. Hogan says he's going to win the title and he's going to retire as the world champion. We get to the match. Now remember, the police station is right across the street from the dome. Not just... That's how it is. They even acknowledged it on TV. Okay, it's not a big secret. The police station is right there. Once they realize that Goldberg is innocent and they're going to let him go, he demands to be taken back. He demands to be driven back to the. I was going to say the Tokyo Dome. That's going to be a hell of a drive if they want to drive him to the Tokyo Dome. He demands to be driven back to the Georgia Dome, which is right across the fucking street. So we are supposed to believe that in an hour or a half an hour, however much time he had to make it back in time, he needed a ride. He couldn't cross the fucking street. So he doesn't make it back in time. Nash and Hogan are in the ring, circling one another. Hogan pulls back for a big strike, big punch he's going to throw. But instead, he lightly pokes Nash in the chest with his finger, and Nash took a bump like he had been shot by a sniper on the roof. And Hogan pins him, and we learn that it was all a ruse for months. All of this drama within the NWO, it was all staged for the purposes of getting to this moment to get the title back onto Hogan. The NWO is united again. Finally, Goldberg makes it back into the dome. It's too late, though. They all beat him down. They leave him for dead. That's how they end the show. The old bait and switch on their big championship main event, including all of the people in the Georgia Dome that night who paid for a ticket to be there to see Goldberg challenge for the title against Kevin Nash. They had 40,000 pissed off people in the building that night. And some people credit this angle as the downfall or the beginning of the downfall of WCW. Although if you believe Eric Bischoff, it goes back a year earlier to the debut of Thunder on TBS. Everybody's got a different answer for what the downfall of WCW was. How's this for an answer? All of the above. All of the above. It was not the downfall of WCW, but it did speed things up. Nash told Sports Illustrated a few years ago, he goes, how else were we going to put together a heel factory for Goldberg to run through? The only thing that had any validity was the NWO, and the plan was to have Goldberg go through everyone. He got pissed off and then eventually got hurt, but that was the original plan. So that was his defense of the finger poke of doom angle that night. I've seen a lot of people, Disco Dipshit being one, among others, who have talked about Goldberg stupidly putting his fist through the limo on Thunder and injuring himself as the reason why the angle had to be killed. And that it was Goldberg who killed the entire thing by hurting himself. Goldberg did have a minor knee surgery in May or June. I forget which. It was either May or June. Many months after this, he had a minor knee operation. The limo incident, this is what people don't understand. People don't have access to a fucking calendar, apparently. The limo incident didn't happen until the end of the year. After his Starrcade match, where he kicked Bret Hart in the head and ended his career. That was December of 1999. This happened in January. Almost a full year earlier. People make it sound like the limo incident happened a few weeks later. It happened almost a year later. But they conflate these events. It's like they think that the limo incident happened immediately after the finger, or within a few weeks of the finger poke of doom. That is not true. That is simply a lie. That is not the case. The revisionist history on this is ridiculous, and it needs to stop. Goldberg did hurt his knee, but he was gone for maybe, I think, 2 months. And that wasn't until the summer. He wrestled all the way through May. He beat Scott Hall. He beat Kevin Nash. He also beat Bam Bam Bigelow in a match on pay-per-view. They sent Goldberg to the Tonight Show. A month and a half after this, they sent Goldberg to the Tonight Show with Jay Leno to issue a challenge to Stone Cold Steve Austin, which Goldberg supposedly did not want to do. Because Goldberg actually had a fucking brain in his head. And he realized that it's going to make me look beneath this guy if I'm the one going out there groveling for a challenge. You know, hey, acknowledge me. It's going to make him look beneath Austin. And he was right. But he did it anyway and he looked like a fool. Austin didn't take the bait because why the hell would he? Why would WWE even acknowledge it? All of this happened after the finger poke of doom. So to hear certain fans and even hear certain WCW guys who worked for the company, in the company at the time that this was going on, to hear them talk about, I mean, maybe they took too many chair shots to the head and their brains were a little bit fogged up. They talk about an injury that didn't occur for another 11 months as evidence of Goldberg screwing up their plans. None of this excuses what they did on Nitro that night. They fucked up. They fucked up, and they pissed a lot of people off. And they squandered whatever goodwill they may have had with a lot of those people. Now, they still did a 5.0 cable rating that night. Raw did a 5.7, which I think up to that point may have been an all-time record for Raw. These are the days where Nitro and Raw, they were combining for a 10 or an 11 audience every single Monday night. This was the peak. WCW would only see that 5.0 mark three more times after this, and one of those times was only because the dog show bumped Raw, so Nitro got to run unopposed that night. After that summer in 99, 4.0 would become a distant memory. And by the following spring, a little over a year after this, they dropped as low as a 1.8 rating. That is how hard and fast the once mighty WCW fell. 20 years ago this week, on January 7th, 2001, the original ECW held what would turn out to be its final pay-per-view event, Guilty as Charged, at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. Nobody at the time knew for sure that it was going to be their final pay-per-view. Some talent and, you know, people suspected it might be, possibly. I mean, the writing was on the wall. They had just lost their TV slot on MSG Network in New York. They canceled their February pay-per-view date, but they were still promoting March 11th as the date for their next pay-per-view. Wrestlers only got half their pay for the show, which put many of them as many as 7 weeks behind on pay. But Paul Heyman was still insisting that the company was not going to shut down. So I can imagine the look of surprise on a lot of their faces when he showed up unannounced as Jerry Lawler's replacement on Raw 2 months later. Hey, that's Paul. What's he doing on Raw? On the show, Rhino pinned Sandman in 60 seconds to win the ECW World title after Sandman had just won the belt in a three-way match. It was a three-way tables, ladders, and canes match. And RVD beat Jerry Lynn in an impromptu main event. Justin Credible and Steve Corino cut a promo to end the show announcing themselves as the new Impact players, but we never did get a chance to see that alliance play out because ECW filed for bankruptcy 2 months later. Of all the promotions, the one that you would think would go out in a blaze of glory instead went out with a whimper. 19 years ago this week, on January 7th, 2002, so exactly 1 year later, Monday Night Raw aired live from Madison Square Garden, featuring the return of Triple H, 8 months removed from tearing his quad, in a Raw match with Steve Austin against Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit. He returned to a gigantic babyface pop to announce that he was entering himself into the Royal Rumble match, which he would go on to win. Still one of the biggest ovations in Raw history. It lasted so long they had to loop his entrance music. And that very same night, Brock Lesnar and Randy Orton, who had yet to appear on TV, each made their MSG debuts in dark matches, with Lesnar beating Rico Constantino and Orton beating Ron H2O Waterman. There's a name I haven't heard in a while. Ron H2O Waterman. You know, people love to poke fun. I see it on social media all the time. Oh, Kevin Nash tore his quad at this comment. They love to poke fun at Kevin Nash for tearing his quad that one time, while completely ignoring the fact that Triple H tore his quad twice. He tore two quads. I don't see people talking about that. In fact, that second quad tear came this week as well, 14 years ago at the New Year's Revolution pay-per-view, also in a tag team match. It was him and Shawn Michaels against Edge and Randy Orton. He tore it, giving Orton a spine buster. But hey, props to the guy. Unlike Nash, and look, I don't cast aspersions on anybody. I'm sure that's a very painful injury. If I tore my quad, I'd be curled up in the fetal position crying bloody murder. Nash didn't finish the match when he tore his quad. To his credit, though, Triple H, he finished the match. Now, maybe that wasn't the smartest thing for him to do. I'm sure it didn't feel too good. But credit to the guy. He did both times. He finished the match. He was determined to finish the match. 15 years ago this week on January 8th, 2006, WWE presented its second annual New Year's Revolution pay-per-view headlined by an Elimination Chamber match for the WWE title, with John Cena defending successfully against Shawn Michaels, Kurt Angle, Kane, Chris Masters, and Carlito. After which, Edge became the first person ever to cash in Money in the Bank that he had won almost a year earlier at WrestleMania. 280 days he held on to that briefcase. He cashed in and he defeated John Cena to win his first WWE Championship, the very first Money in the Bank cash-in, which led to a live sex celebration on Raw the next night with Edge and Lita that featured some accidental nudity, which is, of course, edited out of every single version now that WWE airs on the network or their YouTube channel. But I remember, there was some accidental nudity under the covers that night from Lita. Ratings went up. Sure, a lot of things went up during that segment, but ratings went up for the few weeks that Edge was champion. He defended the title on Raw in a great TLC match against Ric Flair, better than it had any right to be. I mean, Ric Flair at that point in his career in a TLC match. But they had a great match. Didn't stop them, though, from putting the title right back on John Cena 3 weeks later at the Royal Rumble. On Talk is Jericho years ago, Edge said that he knew it was only meant to be a short-term thing. He knew that going in, and they had their plans. But when they saw how well things were going, he said they could have easily dragged it out to WrestleMania 22. And he could have dropped it right back to John Cena on that show. And he's absolutely right. But then Lord Helmsley wouldn't have had an opponent that year. And we can't have that now. Triple H had to have his match. Now, he did put John Cena over in that main event, and that was a big deal to see Triple H, top name in the company, put John Cena over clean in the middle, tapped out. I mean, look, that was a big deal. But it's just a shame that Edge's run, which it was doing well, it was resonating with people. It did not have to have the plug pulled on it that quickly, but they had their plans, and they were going to stick to their plans. 11 years ago this week on January 4th, 2010. We talked about January 4th, 1999 as being a big night in history. This was also a very big night in wrestling history. This was the Monday night, the return of the Monday Night War, or as I called it at the time. God, how long have I been doing this podcast? Jesus Christ. But yes, at that time, I referred to it on the podcast as the Monday Night Skirmish, which I think was a better description of what this really was. Not really a war, more of a skirmish. With TNA Impact, which aired on Thursdays back then at that time, they were airing a live 3-hour special on Spike TV opposite Monday Night Raw. Dixie Carter had signed Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff to come to TNA, and they were making their debut on TV that night. Kevin Kay, the president of Spike TV, said the plan was to air quarterly specials on Mondays throughout the entire year, but if the ratings for the show were strong, they could potentially move Impact to Mondays on a permanent basis. Vince Russo, who had lingering issues with Hogan and Bischoff from their time together in WCW, he was writing TNA television at that time, and the three of them met before the show. I don't know if it was that day or in the days before, but they met together before the show to put their differences behind them. Not only did the show feature the debuts of Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff, it had the debut of Ric Flair. It had returns for Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, Sean Waltman, Sting, Jeff Hardy, all of whom at one time or another had been in TNA. And debuts for Val Venus, under his real name, Orlando Jordan, and the Nasty Boys. WWE countered with the return of Bret the Hitman Hart, making his return to Raw for the first time in 12 years. This is the first time Bret had done anything on Raw, anything on TV, other than the Hall of Fame, with this company since the Montreal Screwjob. So this was a big deal that Bret was coming back on Raw that night as the guest host. And TNA made sure, these bastards made sure, I don't blame them, but as a fan, it was very frustrating. They made sure to time Hogan's entrance right at 9 p.m. when Bret Hart was walking out on Raw. I stuck with Bret, but I had my finger on the remote in a way that I hadn't done since the days of flipping between Raw and Nitro. So you think about it, it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. But when you're actually doing it, it's fucking frustrating as all hell, right? Because you don't know what to watch. You don't want to miss anything important. I don't think I had DVR back then. I never had TiVo or anything like that. So I was still, at that point, I was probably still relying on VCR tapes. It was very frustrating. But on Raw, Bret Hart called out Shawn Michaels, and the two of them buried the hatchet in the middle of the ring. Later on in the show, he confronted Vince McMahon, who kicked him in the balls, left him laying to end the night. Raw easily won the night, which was no surprise. 3.6 rating to Impact's 1.44. 5.6 million people for Monday Night Raw. Viewers, I should say. For Monday Night Raw, which, it's, I mean, it's so sad. It's so sad to even compare it to today. I mean, my God. My God, they trot the legends out. They trot the legends out on Monday night this week. And what did they get? Did they even break 2? I don't even think they broke 2 million. I think it was 1.8 or 1.9 for Raw Monday night, for Legends night. It's pathetic. And 2.2 million viewers for Impact, which was Impact's largest ever audience, even to this day. They've never come close to that ever again. They peaked. Think about this. Impact, okay? And think about where Impact is today. Impact peaked with 3.36 million viewers at 9 p.m. when Hogan made his entrance. And so it was that Spike decided to move Impact full-time to Mondays, opposite Raw, starting on March 8th, which turned out to be a complete disaster, with Impact's ratings dropping 7% from its previous year's average before the move to Mondays. They actually lost audience on the move that I don't think they ever got back. And by May, they were forced to tuck their tail and move back to Thursday nights. And finally, 8 years ago this week, on January 9th, 2013, Big E Langston defeated Seth Rollins in a no-disqualification match to become only the second NXT champion in history, in a match that was called by Jim Ross and William Regal. It's one hell of an announce team. And that is this week in wrestling history. A very busy, newsworthy week of wrestling events. If you have questions or comments you would like to submit to the mailbag, the place to do so is thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. That is thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We've got Chase Pock from Braintree, Massachusetts. Less with a question and more with a request from AEW. This is what he has to say. Thanks for the awesome content. I'm the guy who has written a couple of times, really not understanding the love for Kenny Omega. This was prior to the heel turn. This week, Omega faced Rey Fénix in a who do I care less about match. It could alternately be called a drop you on your head match. I admit that I am getting into this new Kenny Omega character, but in the ring, nothing has changed. If he's a heel, he should at least try to cheat. But more importantly, I don't understand why pretty universally everyone praised this Omega Fénix match so strongly. This was dudes getting dumped on their heads, repeating spots we had already seen twice that night, like getting the knees up. But that pales in comparison to the real reason I hated this match. I don't care about Rey Fénix. You said yourself that Rock versus Hogan is a 5-star match to you. Then this was a 0-star match. I know not every match on TV can have a story, but this was a rare main event world title match on TV, and I just didn't care at all. For fans who have never seen a Kenny Omega match or a Rey Fénix match prior to AEW, and let's extend this to the show closing angle with the Bullet Club, I've never seen anything with them either, I just don't care about any of this. I want to. AEW, make me care. So that is from Chase Pock. James from Staten Island. I look at how everything is playing out with a SmackDown star obviously winning the Men's Rumble, and with the Tribal Chief obviously not dropping the title anytime soon, I just cannot get invested in the Rumble or WrestleMania this year. Even with Daniel Bryan possibly winning the Rumble, there is no way in hell they are taking the title off Roman Reigns. So I don't even know why anyone would bother being invested for the Rumble or their impending Mania match. Because deep down, I don't think anybody wants to see Roman beat Daniel Bryan. What do you think? I think you're being a little too hard on it. I mean, I believe that Roman is going to retain. If it is Roman and Bryan at WrestleMania, I do think he's going to retain. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion, though. Nothing is a foregone conclusion. You know, I'm making certain predictions and pitching certain ideas. That doesn't mean Bryan is going to win the Royal Rumble match. We've been down this road before. Need I remind you about 5, 6, 7 years ago, okay? When we thought Daniel Bryan should win. Daniel Bryan's going to win. Daniel Bryan did not win. And the same could happen again now. The same could happen again this year where we think he's going to win and he ends up not winning and it's somebody else. We don't know where it's going to go. I like the storytelling that they have been doing with him on SmackDown. I think it's one of the few really good things about WWE programming recently. So if you're not going to allow yourself, just because you think, okay, in the end it's not going to matter, well, you don't know that. So why let it ruin what I think right now is pretty good storytelling because of what might possibly happen in 2 or 3 months? So, I can't convince you to suddenly, you know, feel differently about it. I think you're being a little hard on it. I'm not saying you're wrong, that's not how it's going to work out in the end. But these people, they don't know what they're doing from 1 week to the next. Vince McMahon didn't even know that Goldberg was going to be on Raw challenging for the championship until 48 hours before the show. He could blow everything up in 2 weeks. So I'm enjoying what they're doing so far with the main angle on SmackDown. Whatever happens going forward to WrestleMania is going to happen, but to me it doesn't affect my enjoyment level of the show right now. And just because you can predict something is going to happen, you know, it was a lot easier, I think, to predict some of these long-term stories 25 years ago, 30 years ago. Now, I was a lot younger back then, but I don't think even if I were older, if I knew, okay, obviously Hogan is going to go to Mania, Hogan's going to win the belt back, he's going to beat the Macho Man, it wouldn't have stopped me from enjoying the Mega Powers split any more than I did. It's still one of the greatest angles that the company has ever done. But yeah, there was probably no doubt in people's minds who was going to win that match at WrestleMania. It didn't make it any less good. That's the comparison that I would make. Gabe from Los Angeles. I keep hearing rumors about CM Punk returning this year at the Royal Rumble. I don't know where you're hearing those rumors from, but you didn't hear it from me. He says, I do know that Punk said on Renee Young's podcast it would take a really cool idea to get him to come back. What if that idea is him winning the Rumble and challenging Roman Reigns at WrestleMania, giving him the main event he always wanted, and Roman a big name to beat? What are your thoughts? I don't think CM Punk gives a fuck about the WrestleMania main event anymore. I think he did 6, 7 years ago. It bothered him. I truly don't believe he gives a shit at this point. So him going to the WrestleMania main event, who cares? They're going to do it just to make him happy. I don't think he cares. But I do think he's open. I heard him on the Renee Young podcast too. And he's a lot more open to the idea of it, of a return, than he has sounded before. Where if they came to him and said, look, obviously, I'm sure they would have to make a really good offer to him, but hey, we got this really cool idea. Or so-and-so really wants to work with you, and we'd love to work with you again, and here's our idea. I think he'd be receptive to it. I don't see the benefit in bringing CM Punk back until you get people back in the building. He really is that last... It's been so many years now, I think it's... He really is that last big name left to make a big return who we haven't seen in many, many years. So a long enough period of time has gone by where his music hits and he comes out, let's say, as a surprise, or even if it wasn't a surprise, if people knew he was going to be there, it would be this great moment and it would just be more impactful. Can he move tickets to the shows and can he make a difference in that way? I don't know, but I certainly would want to wait and find out and not blow it on a fucking Thunderdome show. I don't really see what is to be gained there. I don't know why Punk would even want to come back. Unless it was in front of an actual audience. But would I have him come back and win the Rumble and go on to Mania? No, absolutely not. I don't like that idea at all. I don't see... Not only do I not see it happening, I don't think with the other options they have for Roman Reigns' opponents, who are far more deserving of it at this point, right, because of the stories that are being told on TV, to throw all of that away just to bring Punk back to give him the WrestleMania main event that he used to care about, who cares? Because I don't think he does. Not anymore. Mike from Pennsylvania, after hearing you talk about Tony Khan buying the rights to Tarzan Boy and how much you love that song, I had to go check it out. Song title and the band name really didn't ring a bell. I also couldn't remember the Listerine commercial where you said you first heard it used, but after listening to it, I got super excited. I remember when I first watched Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, which is the worst of those movies, by the way. It came out when I was 7. This song was in the movie. I think it played at the end of it. It's been a while since I watched it. I remember back then how much I loved that song and how catchy it was. I'm so happy that Jungle Boy that is going to be able to use that song. A full crowd singing along with it will be absolutely amazing. I can picture the crowd singing the chorus even after the song ends, the same way they do for Judas and for Sami Zayn's music. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. It may not happen this year before we get those big, big crowds. But man, I'm telling you, that entrance is going to be must-see when they get that going for Jungle Boy. Lewis from Northampton, England. How do you think The Rock would have been written off TV the night after WrestleMania 17 had Stone Cold not turned heel? I'm not sure that he would have been on Raw the next night. You know, if not to use him the way they did to get over the two-man power trip, if they weren't going to do that, then I'm not sure he would have been there. I mean, you know, maybe a handshake with Austin at WrestleMania out of respect, and then he just disappears for a few months to go film his next movie. What I would have done, you know, Triple H was the next likely challenger for Austin, even though he lost to The Undertaker at WrestleMania. Because Triple H had a victory over Austin that he could point to in their Three Stages of Hell match a couple of months before. He could just say, look, I've already beaten you once, and I can do it again. I should be next in line for a shot at the title. On Raw, you promote a segment all night long with The Rock, making some kind of big announcement. They don't tell you what it is, but it's some kind of big announcement, so people think, oh, what is he going to challenge Austin again? Is he going to retire? Like, what's he going to do? And you get to the end of the show, because that's the best. You want a hook, right, to keep people watching. That's always, you want to have a good hook. You get to the end of the show, out comes The Rock, he makes his big entrance, finally, does all his usual shit. And then, before he can actually make the announcement that he's there for, which there is no announcement, it's just the tease of one, before he can make the announcement, out comes Triple H to attack him. Or, you know what? Better yet, maybe he does issue a challenge, or he talks about how The Rock is not done yet with the WWE title, Stone Cold, you were the better man last night, but blah, blah, blah. And Triple H comes out because he, in his mind, I'm next, not you. And he attacks The Rock, viciously attacks The Rock, to the point where it's a major injury angle to explain him being gone for all those months that he was going to be away filming a movie. Maybe Austin shows up at the very end of the attack to make the save. You know, I mean, Rock did pay him respect with a handshake, let's say, the night before. So Austin is coming out to try to save The Rock. But by then it's too late. The damage is done. Rock is out. And now he's got a ready-made program waiting for him with Triple H when he comes back later in the year. So to me, that's how I would have done it. Because you've established him as the next challenger to Austin, as far as you know, Triple H is concerned. So I can see why he didn't want to wrestle Austin straight away after Mania, because, look, he was smart enough to know. Triple H was smart enough to know being Austin's first challenger after Austin just won the title back, his first title win after neck surgery, he wasn't dropping that belt so quickly. Triple H had to know, I don't want to be the first one in line because I'm going to lose. Maybe we could even get two or three matches out of it, but I'm not going to win. He's going to beat me and move on to the next guy. I don't want to be, you know, one and done, forgotten about, knocked down the card. Better for him to be aligned with Austin. Better for him to be partners, to be equals with Stone Cold on television every week. Then later on, you can build to a split in the two-man power trip, and Triple H maybe even goes babyface, and he can be the hero who challenges Austin for the championship. I mean, look, Triple H was sitting in on all the production meetings back then. We know this. People have talked about it. I'm sure he had some level of influence on his and other ideas. You can't tell me that he didn't have any influence in the direction that his character was going to be going in after WrestleMania. Vince McMahon has final say in everything, but you can't tell me that Triple H didn't have some kind of influence or input into that whole two-man power trip idea that they did the next night. Of course he did. And Jerome, from Sin City, USA, what do you consider the best match that the Hart Foundation ever had? I assume that we are talking about the Hart Foundation tag team, the Anvil and the Hitman, not the group from 97. If it's the group from 97, then the only match of that kind I could think of them having, which is one of the best matches in company history, is the 10-man tag from Canadian Stampede. I mean, that match is legendary. But my personal favorite Hart Foundation match has always been the 2 out of 3 falls match at SummerSlam 90 with Demolition. It wasn't like a 5-star fantastic wrestling match, but I always loved that match. I love that match. I love the finish and the crowd exploding and everything. And I just always looked at that as being my favorite Hart Foundation match when I thought back to it. But they had so many great matches with different teams. They had great matches with the Bulldogs. People speak fondly of their series of matches with the British Bulldogs. They had great matches with the Rockers. They had great matches with the Brainbusters. But after seeing the match that they had with the Killer Bees in Madison Square Garden, I mean, Bret handpicked that match for his DVD. When his DVD came out about 11 years ago, 12 actually, I think 2009 is when Bret's DVD came out. And he curated a lot of the content that was on there. He went into the studio and handpicked the content that was on all 3 discs. And one of the matches he picked, I think it was on disc 1, was kind of like a random Madison Square Garden match between the Harts and the Killer Bees. I think that may have been the best match that I've ever seen the Hart Foundation have. It was that match against the Killer Bees. It was February of 1986. And it went to, I think, like a 20-minute... time limit draw. There was no winner, but it was a hell of a match. So I might actually say the Killer Bees match might have been the best Hart Foundation match I've ever seen them in. But that 2 out of 3 falls match at SummerSlam 90 will always have a place in my heart. Keep sending in those questions. Got some good ones. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. You never know when the next Sound Off inbox might be dropping. I might be going live on YouTube. Right, we just did one on New Year's Eve. The two that we've done so far since I brought it back for the 13-year anniversary in November and on New Year's Eve were huge successes. I got so many questions and so much support from you guys just hanging out for 3-4 hours on end. We're definitely going to do another one soon. It might be a few weeks. So if I don't get to your questions on the show or respond to you directly like I do with some people, it might pop up on an inbox coming up. So, you know, you just make sure you put Sound Off Inbox in the title if you want it to be considered for that. But I read everything you guys send me, even if I can't respond to it right away. So definitely hit me up there, @Solomonster on Twitter. Over 30,000 followers strong. I want you to be one of them. @Solomonster is the handle. Head on over to the YouTube channel because we got more content coming your way on there. I want you guys to like the videos. I want you guys to subscribe. Make sure that notifications bell is fully on, not only on a little bit. That way you'll get all notifications when I go live, when there's a new video that goes up. You'll be alerted. You can run right over to YouTube and watch the new video. Got a lot of ideas in the head for 2021. It's going to be a fun year. I hope you'll join me for the ride. Episode 687 is coming up next Sunday. Watch for my top 10 matches of 2020 video going up on YouTube in the next few days. I may or may not, depending on how long it is, push the audio out to the feed. Even if I do, go to the YouTube anyway and hit like on the video, because you help the video out every time you do that. I'll see you guys for AEW Dynamite Live. New Year's Smash Week 2 review coming up on Wednesday. And like I said, 687 coming up next Sunday. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. And I'll see you back here next Sunday for more Sound Off. Take care, guys.
The Salah Monster sounds off.
Oh, we were told by Triple H that night 2 years ago, they're going to give the fans what they want. You are the authority. And everybody cheered, yay! Because 2 years later, and things are no better off now than they were then. They're worse. Absolutely nothing will change in this company until one thing happens, and one thing only. Vince McMahon must resign as the lead creative force in World Wrestling Entertainment.
The Salamonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Salamonster on Twitter @Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Salamonster Sounds Off.